Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio.
Oh yes, it is Friday the 13th, so we shall endeavor not to have bad luck cross your path on this Friday the 13th.
Anyway, having too much fun. Actually, I did my Friday the 13th show yesterday because I had time to do it yesterday. I don't have time to do it today. I was going to play the last hour today of my Friday the 13th, last hour WBY, where my last guest was Ron DeSantis. So if you want to hear that interview, you can check that out yesterday from yesterday's show. But it was great. We had Jason Shepherd on from Wimkin Social Media. It was just a blast. We had, it was an intense discussion on the First Amendment. I had two epic rants. I must be getting better at this. I don't know. Tara can tell me when she tells me about the show from yesterday. But the first 42 minutes and the last half hour were the last 25 minutes. Unbelievable screaming. Anyway, I got a new theme. Tara, I made you a theme. So let me see what you think of it. I haven't heard it since I made it, so this is going to be kind of a treat for me too. So I try to get a theme for everybody's intro to the show, and this is the one I made for the Animal Shelter Report. Can't you just see yourself all curled up on the couch with a really cute kitty cat just hanging around your neck? Or some adorable lap dog just looking up at you with those big eyes? Maybe you need a dog for hunting, for herding, for protecting the family, or just to take walking. Maybe the house just needs a family cat, or, when available, a pet bird. Where can you find these wonderful animals? At your local animal shelter. And now it's the Santa Rosa County, Florida Animal Shelter Report with Tara D. Isn't that cute?
Yes, I like it. I like it.
Okay, good. So that's how I introduce your show now. So, yeah, I had one person that we went through six different variations before we found one that Wendy liked. Well, I was pretty sarcastic with her, so that's different. So now that we've kind of mellowed out from the day and we can talk about critters, let's get the contact information up front, and we'll probably do it again as well. But let's do that, and then you can tell me what's been going on this week.
Okay, so this is for Santa Rosa County Animal Services. Our phone number is 850-983-4680, and our address is 4451 Pine Forest Road, Milton, Florida. And we can also check us out on santarosa.fl.gov/animals. That's our website. And you can check us out on Facebook and Instagram.
Sounds good.
Yeah, okay. But did I miss one?
Did you have a slight interruption there? Because you're at work right now, right? You're calling from the
yes,
shelter?
Yes, I'm at work. I'm trying to multitask. That's probably the problem. So our friends of Santa Rosa Group is supposed to try to give us a call in today. So I was just checking in with them to see if they're going to be able to make it. And it looks like
okay. They
are. So they should be cool. Giving you a call here in a few.
I'll see it pop up on the screen.
Okay. Yeah.
Unless somebody calls
so,
us from like Azerbaijan or something like that.
Oh,
so
yeah,
a whole different place.
Yeah.
Stuff
we'll just make
there.
Them give us animal information for sure. So.
That sounds good. Yeah, exactly. Well, we should talk about pets in different countries. That's actually an interesting thought in international travel, but we'll save that for another day. Give you a chance to think about that. But yeah. So what's going on?
Well, we've had a busy week this week, just a lot of activity at the shelter. We have another adoption event this weekend, which is going to be at our local PetSmart store. So we've got some puppies that are going to be coming in for that. We had a local meeting at the Chamber of Commerce last night with local rescue groups to just kind of touch base with everybody in the area to kind of just reaffirm our mission of, you know, trying to help the animals and help each other and things like that. So just kind of our bi-yearly meeting just to kind of get in touch with everybody, see where everybody's at, what their strengths and weaknesses are, things like that. What else do we have? We have a rabies clinic going on this afternoon at the shelter, so we're excited about that. That's being put on by the Santa Rosa County Health Department, and it's offering $10 rabies vaccinations as a drive-through clinic, so it's super simple. You don't even have to get out of your car, and that way if someone is, you know, behind
wait,
on their
clinic?
Shot.
Oh, so wait, hold on. Drive-through clinic? Wait a minute, how does
drive-through
that work?
Drive-through clinic, yeah. So
do you have like
basically
a picture
they go
of pets on the board
get in line
or something?
With their car, they fill out some paperwork, drive on through the vet and their staff. It's a different vet. It's not our vet from the shelter. It's a couple of local vets usually handle the rabies clinic, and they basically pop them with the vaccination while they're in the car. Generally, they don't even have to get out of the car. Unless it's a cat, they are going to bring those in to a little area and vaccinate them because, you know, cats are a little special. So, yeah, but that's a
especially
way for
black
people
cats
to have.
Today, we'll talk about that.
Yeah. So we might see some of those too. But yeah, we just try to make sure that everybody's vaccinated because it is required by law. But some people can't afford going to the veterinarian and doing a full exam. So at least this way they can be, you know, vaccinated, their animals are safe, and get that taken care of and at a really low cost. And it's been the same price for many years, so they haven't gone up on the price. And I think the health department does this at least once a year usually here at the shelter.
I mean, I just see like a fast food place, right? So you pull up and you have the menu with all the burgers and fries and things like that. I can just see a menu with like vaccination, spay, neuter, you know, pet selection. You just pull up. Hi, what can I help you with today? Drive through. Welcome to the San Rosa County Animal Shelter drive through. Are you here for vaccinations? You know.
Okay. Would you like a side of dewormer with that? Sure. Thanks.
Want some dewormer with your vaccination?
The local clinics actually kind of do it that way. They kind of do, not the drive-through part, but they do the clinics where you just come in and you add a la carte basically what you need, and you can get just a rabies shot or you can get the dewormer. So they let you kind of pick and choose what you want. So, but we don't offer all that. This is just strictly rabies, just get you legal and get you out of here.
So how much of a problem is rabies these days?
I think I want to say it's around $30 if you go to your veterinarian.
No, not the shot, but rabies itself.
How big of a problem is it?
Do we have, has rabies, you know, been found in animals? Has it been found in people? What's the story on that?
Yeah, so it has been found in animals. I don't know if we've had any this season or not, but, you know, it is fatal. So if an animal contracts rabies, he's a goner. And pretty much the same with people. I know there's a couple cases where people have been treated, but it's pretty much if you get rabies, it's not a good thing. This is not something that's treatable. So, you know, a lot of viruses are treatable, but rabies is not. Pretty much.
So it's a virus?
You know, yes, it's a virus. So it affects the nervous system. And so in the olden days, they called it hydrophobia, which I don't know if anybody watches the old Westerns. I think it was Big Valley had an episode where he got bit by, I think it was like a wolf or something, and then he thought he was going to die, and so he thought he had the hydrophobia, and so so he left the area, and basically fear of water, and the reason that is so if they're at the end stages of the disease, which is why we quarantine for 10 days, so if we get a bite or a scratch, the health department requires that an animal be quarantined for rabies to observe them to see do they have it, do they not. The premise is within, if they're at the end stage of the disease and that's why they bit you, they're in the last 10 days, they're going to die basically. And then if that happens, you know, okay, they did have rabies. The only way to test for rabies is to send off tissue, and it has to be from the brain. So you can't really just, this animal has rabies. So you observe them, and then if it's sometimes, you know, animals do do not display symptoms, and most likely they're good. But we have had incidents where we have had positive animals. Cats. I don't know that we've ever had a dog, but I know we've had, you know, a couple cats over the years. We've had raccoons that were positive, obviously, and they're carriers. But
raccoons, possums, and different animals like that.
Possums,
I think raccoons
not,
are most likely.
But,
possums not.
But raccoons definitely. Yeah, they're pretty low on the totem pole. Definitely, raccoons are one of the top carriers. So, and really don't see raccoon to person transmission as much as raccoon to animal, and then animal to person. So that's one of the most important reasons to vaccinate your animals, is because if they, you know, we want to keep them safe. If they're outside, they could get exposed to something. We want to make sure that they have that rabies vaccination. Now, if your animal's indoor, out, strictly indoors, you still want to do it just in case, also because it's part of, you know, it's legally required. If your cat is out, indoor, outdoor, absolutely you want to make sure that is current. We have seen, you know, cats with rabies in the past. We actually, I think a year or two ago, probably a couple years ago, we did have an incident where this lady had been feeding a feral, don't know if he was a feral cat, but a stray community cat. And one day he just randomly attacked her leg, and it turns out that he had rabies. Most likely he was bitten by, you know, a wild animal, and she had to go through the whole series of vaccinations, which is, from what I understand, can be quite painful. So, yeah, it's just something super important to make sure that you're staying on top of.
Okay. I think I have your guests here. We're going to find out in a second. So
okay,
I'll bring
great.
Our folks on live. And let's enter and sign in, please. Welcome to Action Radio.
Hi.
Who we got here?
This is Michaela Garcia from the Friends of Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter. Sarah invited us over to join you guys for the talk show.
Well, I knew you were coming. I just didn't know which week. So this is good to have you here.
Surprise.
So, Michaela, welcome to the show. And get a little closer to your phone or microphone or however you're doing it, because you're just a little bit quiet there. So don't be shy. You're only talking to, you know, most of the world. Sorry.
No pressure. Sarah was like, oh, we just did the talk show thing. I was like, okay.
Yeah, it's just us here. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. It's awesome to be here.
Well, good. Well, tell me about your organization, what you do, and Tara can, you know, tell me stuff that I don't know as well, and let's go. What you got? What do you guys do?
So we are the Friends of Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter. We're a nonprofit 501c3 that supports mm-hmm. Santa Rosa County mm-hmm. Animal Shelter just in various ways. Our main mission is obviously animal advocacy, education for the public, and just financial support through grants and maybe some things that the shelter itself, since it's not like a direct nonprofit, might not be eligible for. So far we've done, we've gotten some grants for them for surgical equipment. We've got mm-hmm. a dryer over there, new gates for the back of the surgery yard. And we're working to provide microchip readers to all of the fire departments right now to increase.
That's a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know,
yeah,
I don't
and they
think
just
people...
did an... oh,
yeah, go ahead.
Sorry.
No, it's all right.
They
we,
just
we
did an amazing fundraiser. Yeah, little beeper. They do fundraisers throughout the year as well. So they've done pup cup fundraisers, so our animals get special treats. They've done catnip fundraisers. And then recently they did an auction fundraiser, so they raised almost $1,500 for the shelter. So they're always coming up with great ideas to help get funding for different projects that we're doing at the shelter, as well as just helping further the mission.
Yeah, you two sound almost enough alike that I'm going to have to really listen to distinguish you. So I might ask you, who is this speaking now? It's kind of funny, actually, but that's okay. I don't think people realize how much money it takes to run the shelter. I don't think people realize how big the shelter is, how involved it is, how many staff you have, how many vets or veterinarians and other folks that you have there that are all part of this. This is a big operation, and I don't think, you know, I mean, the counties, and we're not a huge county. So what are things like Broward County, some of the bigger counties, you know, the major city counties? I don't even know how they do this, but this is pretty substantial. This is a huge need for this. Who wants that one?
Yes.
Go ahead, fight for it.
I think Santa Rosa County is a tough area, too, because the shelter is obviously up in Milton, right?
Right.
So a lot of the people down in the South End, and that was one of our main goals as the Friends of as well, was to mm-hmm. kind of bring awareness to the South End, because Navarre and Gulf Breeze are almost smack dab in the middle of Pensacola Humane, same distance to the Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter. And
right.
that a lot of people don't even know who their county shelter is. So when they're providing support, the financial, the donations, things like that, they're kind of just going to whatever is closest by car, while Santa Rosa County is the one who's obviously actually out here helping their animals and doing the things for the county, right?
Yeah. Interesting. Okay. I'm going to turn this over to Tara here for a bit. So tell me more. What have you folks been working on? What's going on?
Let's see. We have an adoption event actually on November 4th, so we're super excited about that. It's going to be here at the shelter, so we're looking for local vendors. If anybody's interested, they can just contact me here at the shelter. So it's going to be pirate themed because we are kind of partnering up with a local Mardi Gras group called the Crew of Wicked Pirates. So I think it's their first year. Yeah, so they've chose us. We're going to have it pirate themed. So their float is a pirate ship. Yeah. I'm going to absolutely dress up.
Like
yeah, it's so much fun.
Okay, fine.
So our prime dog for this event is plankton. His name is Plankton, so we're going to be, you know, hey, you want to walk the plank or just walk Plankton? So there you go. But he's
Stop right there. That's funny. Wait a minute. Come on. You race so fast.
And he's a one-eyed dog.
Are you going to put a patch on him? Come on, tell me.
Yes, absolutely. We are totally.
You're
right.
Hang a cutlass off his hips.
As long as he permits it. I don't know how far we'll go with it. Whatever he's comfortable with. So Plankton. We don't want to pressure him.
You know, the first thing I thought was you named your dog after a crustacean, which I thought was rather interesting. But then it makes sense to say Plankton. Okay, fine. Yeah, okay. Walk Plankton. Got it. It's perfect. I love
it. Yeah. He's going to kind of.
Sorry.
He's going to be our main dog, though. But we're going to have some vendors here that day as well, so we're excited. Mm-hmm. It's kind of it's a little last minute. Normally we plan it a little more in advance, but that was the day that we were able to pair up with the crew, and so we're really excited about it, and we're still looking for vendors for that day. So if anyone's interested, they can contact us. We're looking for food vendors and craft vendors, and we think it's going to be just a fun day for everybody, and it'll be here at the shelter in Santa Rosa County, and adoptions will be only $5, and it'll be from 10 till 2.
What's the date again and times?
November 4th. So we've got a couple weeks
that's
on that
short
one, but
notice.
In the meantime, we can get the crew on.
We'll have them talk.
Yeah, we have. Oh, yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, but we've got enough time to plan it and have everybody get excited about it. But in the meantime, we still have PetSmart this weekend, and next weekend we'll be at Petco in Pensacola. So we have events every weekend until then. So we're going to be out and about throughout the town all this month and next month and into December.
Yeah, sounds exciting. Well, I want to hear about all these events. And that's why I'm so glad we do this report. I mean, we've been doing this that long, but there's just such a wealth of information. Michaela, how did you get involved with this? What caused you to – do you run the Friends of Santa Rosa Animal Shelter, or how did you get started in all this?
So I wouldn't say I run it by any means. It is a team. I am the president, but it is a good team of people.
However
and
humble.
So we're still new.
She does an amazing job. She's very humble.
Yeah.
Thank you. So we've kind of started this. We're still really young. I want to say we all started a year and a half ago. And it was mostly just a group of us who got together. One of my previous clients from my work actually invited me over just to talk about the potential. And I love animals. It is what I do for a living. It is what I do in my free time. I absolutely love animals. So I went to this meeting, saw the need, and I decided to join. I don't know. I feel like it was all just very a natural evolution. I was very gung-ho for the mission and the support of the community and the animals in it. So here I am now.
No, that's good. Yeah.
It's really... Yeah.
So if people want to join your organization, what's your contact information? How do folks get a hold of you?
The easiest way to become a member, which we are always looking for members. We're looking for people to help participate and really execute the vision, right? The fundraisers, the events, helping shelter with everything. So to join and become a member, the easiest way is to head over to either our Facebook, Friends of Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter, and click that link tree right there. It says become a member, and it will link you to the document. It's $5 for annual membership. So it's pretty easy going with it. And all that money obviously goes back into our mission for it. So, and we also provide, obviously, updates with everything quarterly, every event that's going on. It's a great mission.
You need a pet parade. I was just thinking of this. You need a little pet parade. Next time there's a festival in Milton, you need like a dog walk right through the middle of the festival. Just clear the people to the side. So now we're going to have the Santa Rosa Animal County Shelter. That's hard for me to say. I don't talk as fast as Tara does, but I'm working on it. Anyway, but you need like a little dog walk. You know, next time they have a, maybe not July 4th because it's a little bit is a little hot for the critters. But just like walk down the street, you know, go down past the Imogene Theater, take a left on Willing Street and go head up, and then they can all jump in the river and have fun. I mean, I don't know. But it's
yeah, so this
have
last
you,
month we actually did a
dog parade.
doggy 3K. It wasn't quite a parade. It was a doggy 3K.
Yeah, tell me about that. How'd that work?
Yeah, it was a little warm. So we're planning another one for St. Patty's Day, and we're planning to have like a costume contest for it and just all the dogs up in green and everything like that. It's still in the planning phase, obviously, for that one. But that one should be a good opportunity for both people to come out with their dogs and kind of dress them up and have fun, and also get the shelter dogs out and get more visibility, because everybody loves a dog dressed up, right?
Oh, absolutely. Do you have prizes for the best Irish wolfhound?
The best Irish wolfhound?
You're doing it on St. Patty's Day. It's the only first Irish dog I could think of. Oh, sure. We're going to bring an Irish wolfhound. It's going to be a grand time.
Any Irish wolfhound will get a prize. We never see those kind of guys around here.
Yeah, they're big. Well, they're huge. Have you ever seen one?
They are. They're gentle giants, though. They're so sweet.
Unless you're a wolf.
Well, yeah, maybe not so much then.
And that's their bread. They're bred to hunt wolves, so they're about as big or bigger than these. It's an amazing dog, that's pretty incredible. Okay, just curious. This is kind of fun. So I got a question actually for both of you. Now we got about 10 minutes left. I was thinking about a friend of mine who's doing some traveling, and the question came up of boarding animals. Do you rate boarders? Do you have any recommendations when people? They're not so much traveling now. Well, they might be traveling for the holidays too. What do you have recommendations? And this is both for, let's start with Tara and then we'll go to Michaela. What about people that want to put their dogs, you know, and cats up for boarding for a while? You guys don't do that at the shelter, do you?
We don't do it at the shelter. We don't really recommend business per se, but I would definitely suggest to people to do your research, check with friends and family to see who they've used. You want to make sure that you're comfortable with who it is, and you want to make sure that, I'd be really scared to go with somebody that I didn't know personally and never heard of. Like, I'd want to go by that word of mouth, like, hey, my neighbor used them and they said they were great, you know, because you're entrusting the care of your sweethearts, your babies, to these people.
Yeah.
And if there are pets that are coming into your home, or if it's a boarding facility, you just want to make sure. And there are a lot of places now that offer like cameras on your pets, so you can actually look in and see how they're doing. So if you're going to be worried about your babies, maybe pay a little extra and get a place where it's a little more detailed, but you have that way to check in on them, and then you can physically see them and you know that they're doing okay. So there are lots of options, but I would just say definitely check around word of mouth. If you're going to a different area where you don't know anyone, just do your research and make sure you don't see any bad reviews, and just kind of, you know, check it out first before you care your animals to someone.
Yeah, reviews can be kind of sketchy because some people just don't like other people and they put bad reviews on purpose. So it's really, I think word of mouth and personal connections are the best way to do that.
Yeah, especially word of mouth would definitely be the best.
Yeah, especially Santa Rosa County, because we all kind of know each other here. It's really, you know, it's a small community. I pity the city folks, but, I've lived in big cities. It's no fun. I like it much better out here. Michaela, what do you think? Do you have any recommendations for people?
Same as Sarah. Definitely do your research, and also think about the dog or cat you have, right, and what their needs are. So some boarding places do big play groups. That may not be the best environment for an older dog who likes to be alone in that quiet time, right? So because there are so many options, I definitely encourage people to think about their individual animal and what would best fit their needs. And nowadays you even have options like Rover and things like that. You don't even
What's
have
that?
To bring your dog anywhere necessarily.
Like pet sitters or something or what?
Yep, pet sitters, and also book early. If you are leaving for Thanksgiving, now is the time to find your boarding facility if you haven't already, because they they book out so far in advance, and I'd hate for someone to get to the point where it's a week beforehand and everywhere is just completely booked, yes. All the holidays, they go very, very quick for the, especially the highly recommended places, right? The really popular ones that people trust, those are booked out very far in advance. So,
yeah, you don't be left with fly-by-night boarders. You know, you don't want to, you know, we'll take
no
care of that last
minute.
Sure, no problem. Yeah, right. I don't think so. Yeah.
But those are my main tips. And also you can do walk-arounds for the facility, too. Tara's talked about the diligence, knowing people. I would go there, too, and meet the people and walk around it as well, just to make sure that you are fully comfortable with what the kennels look like, what they'll be doing every day, kind of get that idea. And you can, with a lot of boarding facilities, you can buy on extra packages of, like, enrichment or cuddle time or whatever extra stuff you want for your dog. So, as a dog advocate, I am going all out for my pup every single time, and I'm always going to the facility to check it out.
You should join us more often. This is good. This is working out well. Tara, I'm going to put this on. Is there more that we should learn about Friends of the Shelter, or do you want to talk about some of the critters that are available for adoption? What's in our 6 minutes left? What do you want to do?
Oh yeah, so just kind of piggybacking on what Michaela has talked about, it's a great way. Let's say if you're in the south end of the county, especially, and you can't physically get to the shelter, it's a great way to support the shelter and help out. They're always looking for new members to help with fundraising, to go to events. The more people they have involved, the more events that they can put on, like in the south end, to get people on in that area involved. Because Milton is a good little hike from Navarre, but yet we're still the same county. So that's a great way to get involved. If you can't physically get to the shelter, you can still put forth a lot of effort and help the animals in our community by supporting Friends of. And they're very active with us. We see them all the time, so it's not like they're not present. They know what our needs are. They're in touch with us. Like we have a thread. We talk pretty much almost every day. So they are definitely in touch with the shelter and knowing what our needs are, what we're looking for. They're constantly writing grants for us, so they're always doing something to help the shelter. So if maybe it's a little too far for you to come, that's a great way to get involved, to still support your area community and the animals that need help, but you don't have to drive so far.
Yeah, makes sense. Now, we're national and international. We'll talk about international sometime later, but not every county, I think, is as fortunate as we are in terms of animal shelters. Michaela, do you reach out to other counties across the country, other states, and see if you can help them and get a chapter set up for Friends of, like the local animal shelter? Because it seems to me there's a real need for this.
No, so we only focus on the Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter. That is our main scope right now. But I do know that other counties who have Friends of, we actually, the thought for Friends of the shelter obviously had expressed a need for it. But there were other Friends of for like Escambia County at one point. So I know there's groups that do the same thing in different counties and different parts of the country as well.
Is there a national organization at all?
You'll have to ask Tara. Tara might know.
I don't think so. I think it's just basically, if you're lucky enough to have a nonprofit that supports your shelter, consider yourself lucky, because not every shelter has that. And if the ones that do have it, it's, vital to their growth. So.
Well, if you don't have one, people out there, you can start one.
You can start one, exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
So, Michaela, because your Facebook page, let's do that again. So if someone wants to start a chapter around the country and they want to kind of model themselves on what you're doing, let's get your Facebook page again.
It is Friends of Santa Rosa County Animal Shelter. Super easy to find us on Facebook. We also have a website, and our email is friendsofthesrcanimalshelter@gmail.com. So you can also reach out to us there if you have any questions on anything.
Sounds good. Okay. And this is podcast, so people can always review it and, catch it that way. Tara, any critters you were featuring this week? We got about 3 minutes.
So I think I may have talked about Sparky last week. She's still here. She's our senior dog that is good with dogs, cats, loves children. She's all around good girl. She's just an old lady with arthritis. She just wants to lay on the couch and just catch some Z's and give some love. And we're hoping to find a home for her. And then we also have a really great guy named Fisher, who's a cute little fuzzy lab mix, maybe lab chow. He's kind of fluffy. We took him to an event yesterday evening, and he was a little shy in the shelter, so we weren't sure how he would do. He was like the hit with all the children. He loved every person he met and was especially excited about meeting kids, but he's very calm. So if someone's looking for maybe a kid-friendly dog that's like a medium size, cute little black lab mix, fluffy hair, adorable, I think he would be a great match for someone. So they should come on up to the shelter and meet our guy, Fisher. He's very handsome as well. And if they go to our Facebook page, there may be a couple pictures of them from yesterday. If not, we'll make sure to get one posted. And then as far as cats, we've just got kittens galore coming through left and right, getting adopted so quickly.
Really?
I don't even know who's up there this week. Yeah, they're getting adopted so fast, which is awesome. So right now I think we have a few, and then they go really quickly. It's kind of like, hotcakes. They get up there, and before you know it, there's another one. So if you come in and you don't see a kitten, just come back in about 3 or 4 days. There's probably going to be new faces.
Now, do you get a lot of the cats from the feral cats out there who are having litters all the time? And I know there's a pretty big population, I think, in Escambia County. I'm not sure how big it is in Santa Rosa County. I mean, we don't have, packs of wild dogs running around that were, former domesticated. But we do have cats out there. So
absolutely.
Yeah, what's going on with that?
A, Yeah, so we have, that's one of the reasons that we continue to try to do our community cat program, which is spay and neuter, and we offer that free to the public for unowned animals, and we post the dates on our website, well, our website and our Facebook page as they open up, and we just kind of do it when we're able. I think September we did a couple, this month we've done one, and that just tries to help curtail that population, and they're not all feral. Some of them are, you can pet them or you can, they'll come up to you. Maybe they don't want you to pick them up, but they're friendly enough, or sometimes they're super friendly. So we just want to make sure these guys are getting their vet care and getting altered as well, because if you're feeding an animal, you're kind of taking on the caretaker role. So you need to
try to, and
sometimes people can't afford to go and get that animal altered. So this is a way that they can still do their part. All they have to do is get them up here during a, Community Cat Day, and we will get them altered. So, and then, you know, some of these kittens that are coming up from animals that are out there that are community cats, if we can get the kittens and if we have space and we're able to socialize them before they're feral, then, you know, these five kittens that were going to be wild are now going to be in loving homes. So we do try to encourage people, you know, if you're able to get a hold of the kittens and work with them and then try to contact us, we can't guarantee we'll be able to take some. It depends on space, but we'll do our best to assist. And we definitely want to help get those moms fixed and the dads neutered as well, so that this problem doesn't continue.
Yeah. Let's get your phone number. And one more time, I got Derek on the line, and we're going to go to our financial report. Totally different report.
Contrast.
Then we go to the gun reports after that. So we have some, it's an interesting day. So let's just get address and phone, and we'll do it again next week. And Michaela, thank you. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, so Santa Rosa Animal Services at 4451 Pine Forest Road, Milton, Florida. Our phone number is 850-983-4680, or check out Facebook or Instagram or our website at santarosa.fl.gov/animals.
Perfect. We'll see you hopefully both next week, but if not, certainly Tara, we'll talk to you next Friday.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right, thanks. Have a good week.
Okay, bye now. Money. What is it? How does it work? How do you get it to work for you? So many choices. Stocks, bonds, mutual funds, commodities. And then there are the markets. Oil, gold, manufacturing, trade, energy, even government. To make sense of all the places your money can go, Derek Park, our Action Radio financial reporter, joins us Fridays at this time to make sense of the markets and your money. Yeah, ho-hum, nothing going on in the economy. Oh, boy. Yeah. Yawn. Good morning, Derek.
Yeah, what's going on?
Yeah, exactly. Lots going on. Well, I want to talk inflation because everybody's worried about the interest rates, but that's not the problem. The problem is inflation causing the need for the interest rates to go up. And so I really wish we could make this – the news doesn't ever make this connection. We do, because we know what's going on. But they're forecasting another $2 trillion beyond the revenue coming in. So that's all deficit spending. So they have to borrow that money. So that guarantees more inflation, which guarantees the interest rates are going to rise. But no one talks about that. Is any of the financial journals talking about this? Or what? You know, but we know that that's the thing. It's the accelerator and the brake. If you step on the accelerator of printing money, you're going to have inflation. And if you have inflation, the customary method of trying to stop it is raising interest rates, which is the brake. But it does nothing if you stand both on the accelerator and the brake. Your wheels are still spinning, and you're just destroying the economy. Does anybody else get that, or they just know it and they don't care? What do you think?
I mean, I think, you know, the people in Congress see it. I don't think they're really to a point where they realize that it's a significant impact. It's a little hard to pin down, you know. I mean, it's like you're trying to figure out somebody's thinking, but it seems like common sense to us. Republicans can't even get their crap together and get a speaker in there. You know what I mean?
That was my next question.
Yeah. You know what I mean? It's just like, okay, you guys really wanted it. Now you wanted it. Now you can't figure out what to do with it.
You don't have McCarthy back because he's a deep state. We call him Kevin McDeep State around here. He made that horrendous deal with Brandon, which I think is unconstitutional. Speaker of the House cannot negotiate with the president directly because all legislation has to come out of the Congress. So the legislation comes first. Then they can negotiate. That's fine. But you can't do it before the bill. Yeah, that's blatantly unconstitutional. So the fact that he made that deal, and I don't know what's going on. This is like the deep state still wants their person in. Because the speaker, now here's what's interesting. When Paul Ryan was speaker or John Boehner was speaker, they were the deep state operative. They made sure that nothing good came out of a Republican Congress. And they're very good at it.
Yeah.
And so now Kevin's job was exactly the same. Nothing good come out of, you'll never see the 12 appropriations bills. You'll never see the logical spending. You'll never see inflation stop, by them actually living within their means. They're just standing on that accelerator all the time. I don't know what the problem is with Congress either, because, we're both in Matt Gaetz's district. And so he's got the right idea.
Yeah.
I think Jim Jordan would be great. I wrote an article on why Trump should be speaker. I didn't like it at first, but as I thought about it and as I read different things that people were saying, I was like, you know what? That'd be an interesting idea. That seems to have gone, though, unfortunately. What do you think that would have done?
I don't know. I mean, Trump is speaker. I mean, I'm sure that's going to stir up more of a hornet's nest. All these folks that are kind of out to get him, that's going to ramp up. They're going to be looking for reasons to.
He could have passed.
Bills. Oh, I'm sure.
Funding most of the Department of Justice. He could have had them all investigated. You could have the special committee on the stolen 2020 election. He could have done a bunch of things. I think it'd be nice to still do that. But, I don't think that's going to happen. Unfortunately, Jim Jordan's like not a bad choice. But how much does the speaker have, in terms of markets? I mean, how much do the markets watch Congress? They just watch the spending? They just wait for the bills to come out? Do they care who the speaker is?
I don't know that. I don't know that specifically. Okay. So, yeah, that's getting a little bit more detailed on my understanding of the government.
Okay. And just to let folks know, I always ask Derek, in fact, I ask everybody impossible questions. Most of these are speculative. There is no evidence for what we talk about a lot of times. But that's what makes it interesting, because so many people are reporting what was, and I'd rather, look into what could be, because I think it's more fun. All right, well, let's go with the report. And then see what other stuff and anything that's of concern to you, you can let me know, and then we can kind of go from there.
All right. Sounds good. Well, good morning, everybody. This is Derek with the Action Radio Financial Report. Stocks fall after September inflation report. Stocks finished lower in response to the September Consumer Price Index inflation report that showed headline CPI came in slightly above expectations, while core CPI continued to moderate. On the labor market front, initial jobs claims were largely in line with consensus expectations and were unchanged at 209,000 from the prior week. U.S. Treasury yields move higher after declining for three consecutive days, with the 10-year finishing around 4.7%. Small-cap stocks were notable underperformer today, shedding over 2%. Overseas Asian markets finished trading firmly higher on news that China's sovereign wealth is increasing its stake in its country's largest four banks, providing a boost in sentiment for the region. The followed news from earlier this week that Chinese policymakers were considering the budget deficit in order to stimulate economic activity. Following this week's inflation reports, the markets will likely shift to corporate earnings over the coming weeks. Oh, wow, this is a big report. My goodness.
Yeah, that's okay. Good thing we started early then. I already have questions for you.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah. And
well,
now,
there's
page two.
The page goes into deeper detail into a lot of things.
Well, you can skip all that. We're
going
to do our own detail. Let's just go for numbers. Yeah.
Right. U.S. equities closed lower, with the Dow Jones down 174 points or 0.51 to 33,631. NASDAQ closed down 85 points or 0.63 to 13,574. And the S&P 500 closed down 27 points or 0.62 to 43,50. Again, in the bond market, Treasury yields trading at 4.71%. In the commodity markets, the price of crude oil was flat at $83.45, and the price of gold was down $5.60, or minus 0.3 to $18.81.70. This is Derek with the Action Radio Financial Report. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
Do you find it interesting that there is more detail in this financial report this week? Are they trying to explain something? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, they've done it before. It just, let's see here. Hold on. It goes into September CPI report, mostly in line with expectations. So it just goes more into the CPI report, So, talks about food and energy. So really, to put inflation into perspective, all the prices on everything are falling except the things Americans use most. Which is going to be
stop right there. That yep. in itself is news. In fact, I find it conspicuously absent that the inflation number wasn't given. What is inflation these days? What do the reports say? Because it's not in that report that you gave. And I'm like, okay, what's the inflation? What's the percent? And it's not there. That in itself to
it's
me was very interesting.
Report. I think it's at 3.8, 3.9.
Well, that's not bad. So just say 4%,
yeah,
roughly. Okay. What's the trend? Has it been increasing, decreasing? Because it was up, I think 9 was the high before they started dumping oil into the our petroleum reserve.
Yeah.
Do you have like a trend
right.
on it? So let's take it from the beginning of Brandon. It was Trump's inflation was like, what, 1%, 2%, somewhere in there? Was really low.
I was trying. We've got a chart that shows the CPI, and I'm looking for it.
Is that the same as inflation, the consumer price index, or is that a different
yeah,
measure?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, that's the inflation, you know, thermometer.
Okay.
Come on, where's the?
I just found it interesting. It was not in the. So here we have a financial report talking about inflation, but they don't actually give the inflation number. That to me is interesting. I just, you know, it's a lot of times it's not what's in the news. It's what's not in the news that can be the most interesting. And why is that not in the news?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So consumer price, and I said 3.9, 3.7 is what
okay.
it's at.
All right.
Yeah. So
a little better, but
that rate
much.
Is effective as of, you know, 2 weeks ago when the data started coming out. So,
okay.
You know, so as I said in the statement, the things we use most, you know, so housing, well, I did see a report that said housing has seen its biggest decrease, you know, in like 3 years, you know, where it was like 10% reduction on average. Some markets more than that, you know, that they're starting to see house prices fall because the inventories are starting to stack. So
okay.
Housing is seeing the impact that they need. Next is food. Food prices are not going anywhere. You know what I mean? Food prices, mm-hmm. according to this report, actually said they went up, you know, so you know, it's food costs are an issue. And then the next thing is fuel. You know, I mean, when fuel costs are up, everything else remains.
Everything else goes
you know,
up.
So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's right.
Energy
you know,
drives
so,
the economy. Yeah.
It is, yeah. So it goes into detail on the CPI, and then the final part of it, which is pretty detailed, talks about corporate earnings that are coming up. So this week is you're going to see some big banks coming in. You know, Wells
Doing
Fargo
what?
Has already posted some positive information. Their quarterly financials.
Okay.
Is coming
All
in
right.
this week.
Right.
Yeah. So that's normally, you know, I mean, big banks, when they come in, it, you know, that's normally a, you
right.
know, a kind of a significant event. You know, so Wells Fargo obviously had some good data that came out. You know, I'm not sure about the other ones or who's in line. It doesn't necessarily say in this report. So I'd have to go look to see who's reporting this week.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking about this. You said that the things that are still higher in price are the things that Americans need most. And that makes sense. It's, you know, basic supply and demand. The demand for food is constant. I don't think people vary how much they eat each week. You know, I'm sure that's – well, although kids grow up and they're going to eat more. But, I mean, but basically the demand for food I think would be fairly constant given the population. Now, of course, if you increase the population, as Brandon has done, we got 15 million people that shouldn't be here. That alone is going to create more demand for food and for energy and for everything else. Do you see that it makes sense that the constant demand items – the luxury items, people can come and go. If they're low enough in price, they'll buy them, but otherwise not. Like travel. You know, if the airline prices suddenly drop to half of what they are, a lot more people would travel. So you can increase demand that way. Or, you know, but because
yeah.
they lowered the price. But food, you know, I mean, there's no incentive for them to lower the price of food because people need food.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Huh. So it will eventually come down because people, you know, if this might even take recession. So you have to realize that you know, people will get to a point where they'll start buying less. You know, I mean, they'll start aiming for cheaper items. You know,
yep.
it's just when they feel the money supply really, really, really take hold.
Mm-hmm.
You know, then you know the shift. You know, buying the expensive deli meats, all that stuff starts to come to an end. you know, buying extra meat, putting it in the freezer, that stuff comes to an end, you know. So eventually, you know, the costs are going to have to come down because, you know, the supply houses are going to start filling up.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
You know, so.
Yeah, from steaks to hamburger, from hamburger to chicken, from chicken to pasta, from pasta to beans.
Right,
you know, I mean,
right.
You just keep working your way down the scale. Yeah.
So we're a long way away from that, though. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, you know, I think, you know, you're still looking at food costs, you know, that are, you know, 30 to 40% higher. You know, I don't know that they're going to go back to that point. You know, I mean, they're never going to go back to that point. Inflation has spiked so bad, you know, you might see a 20% decrease in prices and that's going to be the new baseline, you know?
Right.
So I don't know what that certain number is. You know, same thing with housing, you know, I mean, people thinking, you know, houses are going to go back down to where you can find you a good house at 175 grand. Those days are gone. You know, I mean, like I just, unless the house is, you know, in disrepair, you know, trying to find you something that, you know, is going to be in good condition at a good price, you know, is going to be very hard. I'm not going to say it's not going to exist, but it's going to be very, very difficult to find.
Yeah. Yeah. I haven't been in a position to actually buy a house, but if I bought one in California when I got there in 1984, probably sold it for 10 times what I paid for it, you know, so that would have paid off everything. Then I kind of come out here and bought one for cash, you know, because it was the houses here are like 10% what they were in the Bay Area. So $1.5 million
right.
house in the Bay Area would cost about $150,000 here when I got here in 2017. Now, granted, like you say, those days are gone, but it would have been nice to have the extra capital to buy one, which I would have done, but I just, you know, it's my circumstance. I've got a weird story. I'll tell it later, but you know, but the thing is that if you can look ahead a little bit, you know, and see these trends, housing around here before the boom started, which is probably what, 3 years ago, maybe? When did people start moving to Santa Rosa County? What, you know,
it started probably in, you know, 2018, 2019.
Okay. All right. So I got here at the right time. I just couldn't take advantage of it. Which is
bad. So, I mean, the big boom probably started, you know, I'd call it 18 to 19, but you know, I mean, obviously, you know, the big influx of, you know, people coming from these, you know, overpriced blue states, you know, I would say, you know, that definitely picked up 2021, you know,
right.
That was a, you know, the floodgates of them.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, not just that. I mean, they're higher taxes. I mean, you know, higher cost of living going up, you know, I mean, so when inflation does that, you start to see people looking for some reprieve somewhere.
I'll tell you something else, too, that people don't figure. It's not really reported in the news. I got Pianchi. I'll get to him in a second. But it's miserable. It was miserable living in California. California, when I got there in the 80s, was friendly. It was fun. You know, and, you know, we had real diversity in San Francisco. There is no majority population. It's, you know, it's a quarter white, quarter black, quarter Asian, quarter Hispanic. And we got along fine. But as the pressure, as California developed and boomed and became, quote, more diverse, when they actually worked at political segregation, it became a very unfriendly place. And people started yelling at each other and screaming. And you know, even going grocery shopping became a miserable experience because people of different groups would just cut you off in line, figuring that I had white privilege. You know, and it got that bad. And I said, you know what? I don't want to live here. I'm not going to fight this. It's not going to win. I'm never going to win. I'm never going to beat these people. They're just rude, and I can't deal with it. I've had enough. And so I come here. And all of a sudden, it's like a very military area. People are civil. Everybody's calling me sir. I'm old. But it's nice, at least, because it's polite. So a lot of people are trading a miserable leftist. Of course, now with the looting, it's completely different. I mean, I understand people are leaving. But I don't know if you measure this on an economic scale, but there's a misery scale of people that are getting out because it's just a hostile environment. You know, I had a school that used to protest. They would send their students out in front of a Mexican flag. All right. So a Mexican flag is marching down my street because I used to live about three blocks from an elementary school. They're marching down my street behind a Mexican flag in my country. And I'm furious. Obviously, I'm not going to stop them because the school is doing this, you know, on our tax dollars. But I figure the only solution was to leave. Is that ever measured in terms of you know, why people move? It's not just economics. A lot of it's really cultural. And I don't see that talked about much. Derek?
You know, I mean, I'm sure it is. You know, I mean, it's you know, some people want to escape the cultural differences that are going on, economic differences. I mean, I'm sure it's a mix of it all. You know what I mean? So, and you know, I know one of my family members lived in a town that was kind of overtaken by the bad part of town. You know, and I'm just kind of leave it at that.
No, I understand.
And let's just say they weren't welcome.
You know? Oh yeah.
So
oh, yeah.
It literally forced them out of an area, you know.
Yeah.
So you know, I know even the town that I grew up in, which, you know, wasn't where my side of town wasn't that, but the school I had to go to was definitely a hybrid of it. And I dealt with that stuff, you know. So I just saw an article on it was on YouTube where, you know, one of this guy who's like one of the biggest geopolitical figures in the world, you know, basically who is extreme leftist, you know, got on and said, you know, while everybody thinks diversity is our strength, he said it's becoming our weakness. It's becoming our weakness.
Because we already had diversity.
Because
we're naturally a diverse nation. So,
He was also saying that, like, you know, when you open your borders and floodgates to all of these other ideals and these other, you know, political ideologies, these other, you know, ethnic, these other racial, these other, you know, everything, you know, he says, you know, you're exposing your own culture and your own people to that, and you need to be prepared for the consequences. He says it's not all bad. He says, Glee, in the past, you know, 5 to 10 years, it has been bad. You know, it's resulted
based on assimilation. Immigration based
right.
on assimilation works. People that come here from different places bring us their wonderful culture, food, religion, whatever else they want to bring here is great, as long as they become Americans and understand that freedom and liberty and individual rights are paramount. As long as you understand that, no problem. But if you come here with your culture and you want to take over our country and say that your culture and your country and your politics are better than our founding documents, then no, I have no use for you.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I divide it up.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
For sure.
Pianchi? Let's get Pianchi in this conversation. See cultural, economic moves where people are just sick of an area? They just don't want to be part of, you know, leftist enforced, you know, diversity, communism, and everything else. What do you think? Pianchi?
Well, and good morning, Eric. Immigration is a privilege. Immigration is a privilege, not a right. And people that come to this country, any country, you supposedly add to the development of the country to make it better, not to take from it. And that's what you see going on now. It's a burden. I know what you mean, Greg, when you said you've seen these individuals walking down the street with a Mexican flag in the neighborhood. But you know something? Mexican Constitution forbids that. You can't demonstrate march in Mexico flying a foreign flag.
Yeah, I'm not surprised.
Yeah.
Well, I wrote an article, which I'm going to release one day. I wrote it on Flag Day. I said we should burn Mexican flags on American Flag Day just as a protest. I don't know if I want to do that now, but this is one of my things back there. Well, let's talk about the economy of illegal aliens. Has the market thought about this? Have they thought about the cost of this? And here's a question I've never asked you. NGOs, like Catholic Charities, Lutheran Charities, are they nonprofits? Are they publicly traded? Do people buy stock in Catholic Charities? Or are these totally separate organizations that are exclusively funded by our tax dollars and things like that? That's probably two questions. Let's start with the NGOs.
The answer. That's a tough question.
Okay.
As for, you know, have people done studies on the economic impact of illegal immigration? Yes. I'd have to go. I don't know them off the top of my head, but I know I've seen data on it.
Yeah. Well, I have too, but I'm just curious if it's been reflected in the market. Have people in certain industries saying that maybe cater to illegals like Colony Ridge in Texas? It's an entire city of illegal aliens. Are certain industries benefiting? Like you talked about demand, housing demand. You know, these people are going to want to live somewhere even though they can't be here. So I'm wondering if certain industries are adapting.
Billion.
Go ahead. What's that, Pianchi?
I think it's $114 billion. I read a study a couple of years ago. I believe it's about $114 billion a year.
Mm-hmm.
Impact.
Yeah, it's a statistic. I know it's out there. I've just never seen it.
Yeah.
So,
but how about companies? You know. I'm wondering specifically the market, you know, stocks and things, and certain companies benefit from illegal aliens, like the hotel industry, you know, the chambermaids and dishwashers. The meat processing places are notorious for hiring illegal aliens. So there's certain industries that you're seeing any kind of a change, or is anything being reported on industries benefiting, you know, from illegal aliens and it being reflected in the stock price? I mean, you may not know. I don't know if this is even being reported. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, it holds water, you know, but I'd have to dig. You know what I mean? Like, yeah. I don't know that specific.
Well, if you run across it, I mean, like I say, a lot of these questions I ask, it just, you know, pop into my head right at the spur of the moment while we're talking about it. And so that, I know that's tough on you just because you don't, and you don't have to have an answer. I mean, I keep saying this, you know, you can guess as much as I'm guessing. It just seems to me that there's a business angle to this, that people are making money. The companies are making money off cheap labor because everybody else's wages are being, you know, forced down because they can say, well, I can just hire an illegal, you know, no one's going to stop me. Whereas if we seized their company for hiring an illegal, yeah, they wouldn't do it. So let's talk about labor rate. So when they measure jobs, I've heard some things that these numbers are skewed, that they're really not necessarily new jobs. They might be old jobs from COVID, or they're not taking into account the people that have not, that aren't even looking for a job anymore. What's going on with the numbers on the jobs that, you know, on the reporting of the job numbers?
Okay. So I guess
good question again,
I know there's stuff out there on it.
Right.
I don't know it off the top of my head. Yes, would the numbers be skewed from what happened with COVID, you know, putting people back in place, so on and so forth? Yes,
still.
We all know this, but you know, who's got the numbers? I know there's stuff out there on it. I just have to go dig it out.
Okay.
I mean, are the Bureau of Labor Statistics and all that stuff, are they paying attention to it? Probably not, because it's going to make, you know, the current administration look a lot worse than they are.
Yeah, Bidenomics. Let's say maybe it was something that we can establish. And again, feel free, you know, check the podcast out. Check all these. I got like six questions for you for the next several weeks, probably. Bidenomics is a joke. We know the economy sucks compared to what it could be. And these people are ranting and raving like somehow it's like they believe their own lies or they don't care about their own lies. I mean, is the market taking these people seriously? What's the view on like Wall Street for Bidenomics?
You know, because the news industries are have a little favoritism. You know, it's sad to say that it's very thin. You know, I mean, you see stuff and you see some articles that pop up every once in a while that are like, hey, you know, I mean, this thing's, you know, needs work. And then you go, you know, you get the press secretary, you know, where people start asking the questions and, you know, she gets on there, oh, the economy's just great. You know what I mean? Like, what planet are you living on?
Well, in other words, either she lies, and that's her job to lie. She's paid to lie. She doesn't care. She knows the truth and it doesn't matter. Or she's a complete idiot. I'm not sure which. It's hard to know.
I got a question too, Derek.
Sure. Go ahead.
Robots and AI and any software that takes the place of a human being at work, they should be taxed that employee tax as if they was working. Because when a person, and we know the ramification when a person is no longer working, no longer paying that tax, then the community suffers. You know, you look at California at the period is about $32 billion in a deficit. So I don't know how they're going to raise that money and continue to go up. So what's your opinion? Shouldn't they not tax robots as if they are employees working 24 hours a day?
Oh, man. You guys got
all the
good
questions
today.
I know.
I mean,
kind of fun day for you,
I would... You know, from a revenue standpoint, I would say yes. I mean, I guess, you know, I mean, like if you're cutting out workers, you know, I mean, like the state's not going to have the revenue, the Fed's not going to have the revenue. I mean, if they could replace everybody with robots, yeah, it's more efficient and they save money tax wise, but now the economy eventually suffers. You know what I mean? So it's
Who's going to buy the products the robots make if nobody's making any money? You know, Henry Ford.
Right.
Henry Ford was famous for paying a higher wage than everybody else because he said, look, we need the middle class. I said, if you don't pay these people money, they're not going to be able to buy anything. And this is why I think unions are really good, too, because we'll talk about United Auto Workers in a second. But have these people thought that far ahead that if you replace everybody with robots and you don't have jobs, you know, who's going to buy the products the robots produce?
Yeah, I mean that holds water. I mean, I don't know that I agree with it. Don't agree with it. You know, I mean, I'd like to see some statistics and some studies. But I mean, that's a good thing, Pianchi. I mean, it's like, you know, where do we go?
Hold on, Pianchi.
When you're at the supermarket, you're at the supermarket, and you go through those those cubicles, I guess they call it cubicles, your self-scan station, yeah. Those should be yeah. taxed like the same tax you apply to them. That
and
way,
you say that too loud, man. The government's going to get they're going to start.
Well,
no, you tax the company. It'd be interesting to tax the company for the cost of that. I disagree with that, Pianki, and I'll tell you why. Because what that's going to do is if you tax a robot as a person, you're going to stop innovation in the corporations. You might stop other things that save us money. You might stop more productive means. And the and I think that there's other jobs to be had. There's other things. There's other industries. This opens up for entrepreneurs. I mean, people that lose a salary job, like me, I've never really gotten a good one. So I started a company. So I think that you can have innovation. There are ways to do it. If we did the same thing with blacksmiths, for example, all right? So when the horse and buggy days ended, if we taxed automakers for the cost that we're not getting from blacksmiths, you know, tax people for that, you know, what would that do for the automakers? So I think I've got a problem. I understand what your logic is.
I hear what you're saying, not to get into an argument, but work physically in something else. But when you have, like, in a grocery store, you have self-checkout scanners. Each one of those machines should be taxed, an employee tax. Now, the company still don't have to pay insurance. They don't have to pay workers' compensation. They don't have to pay retire, but you still have to run the community. And the taxes that from the employee tax that goes to – look at Social Security.
Mm-hmm.
Look at FICA.
Right.
And when you take away the input of those, then you start having problems elsewhere. So, no, that's
– Oh, yeah. 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 That's true. You start having problems with Social Security. You know, I mean, that's you know, I mean, I know you listed it, but, you know, I mean, people have to pay into that. If you're not filling that tank, the biggest problem with Social Security currently is that you know, people are living longer, so they're kind of burning up the benefits, right?
They didn't
expect people to live as long.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's interesting when Social Security came in, the retirement age was 65, and the average life expectancy was like 50. So they had 16 years, you know, of free stuff. Yeah. Well, my solution, and I got Candy in line too. Well, let me bring her on and see if she wants to talk about this just really quickly for a minute. And I got a new theme for you, Candy. You're going to love this. But Social Security, the cure is very simple. I mean, it has to go to a Chilean system, which is mandatory 10%, not 15, but 10% of your money goes into an account of your choosing. It's a private account. You can invest it in, give three options, like, you know, stocks, real estate, whatever. It doesn't matter. But you have a very simple investment thing. The government can't touch it, and you get all of it, you know, when you retire, and it's still yours. And then it becomes your family's. You can put it away. And for a 10% investment over the lifetime, you'd make far more money than Social Security would ever give anybody, especially if it compounds over your lifetime. Mm-hmm. Right?
Is this administered by the government, or do they let private companies do it?
I would do it private, but I would mandate.
Well,
from the government.
Of course, they
private.
Would do it private. I was just asking. In this, I don't know about it. I'm going to go look it up. But
look at the Chilean system. Yeah, I've been talking about it for years. Yeah, Cato Institute.
And
in
that instance, right?
Yeah.
In that instance, like if our government got a hold of that, golly, think about what kind of a wreck that would be.
No. It's got nothing to do with government. Government just mandates that it happens. So in other words, say people – so at 18 years old, people start working, just for an example, right? And then 10% of what they make goes into a private account. And say they just put it in the S&P 500. So people with 10% of the money in the S&P 500 over the course of 40 years. 62.
10% of their earnings growing over time. I mean, golly,
compounded.
Man, you know, I mean, even if they worked a basic job, golly, probably $2 million, easy.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so
that
there's your answer
phenomenal.
To Social Security. Candy, what do you think?
Well, you know, so the problem
I think it would be phenomenal.
The
problem with, like, Americans, you know what I mean, like in our society is, you know, we're given the freedom to make that choice. And most people, they choose to not do that. They choose to have TVs and phones and, you know, J's on their
feet.
That's
how you mandate it.
You know, what's that?
But they're already mandating 15%. So I'm talking about a 5% reduction. Okay. 10%. All right. So you get a 5% extra money that the government's not taking because that's 15%.
Who's mandating 15%?
The government is.
Oh, you're talking about for Social Security?
For Social Security, it's 15%. Now, they say 7.5% divided, but it's not. The company sets aside 15% of the money that they would have paid you, and they send it to the government. So it's a 15%
tax.
Right, Okay.
Yeah.
So make it 10, give people 5% more money over the course of their lifetime, and put 10% in a private account, and you have some various investments. They can't touch it. you know, until maybe 62, early retirement, or just make it 60, whatever. It doesn't matter. 60 years will be a great time, so you're young enough to go play and have fun. Anyway, right. Derek, let's get your phone number one more time. I'm going to go to Candy, but this has been fascinating today. I think right. We have more questions than answers.
Yeah, right. all right, well, thanks, everybody. This is Derek with the Action Radio Financial Report. You can get me at 850-995-0082.
All right, thank you. So, Candy, I got a new theme for you. Here we go. Every once in a while, you run across someone who doesn't quite fit the image of who you expect. And sometimes you get totally surprised. This is one of those times. Candy Petticord is a facilitator of A Girl and a Gun, a state leader, DC Project, Women for Gun Rights, a training coordinator, Buckeye Farms Association, a board member of Faster Save Lives, an NRA life member and training counselor, and a USCCA instructor. And for the rest of the story, you'll just have to listen to Candy Petticord, because this is the Black Mama Bear Gun Report on Action Radio.
Yes!
There you go, Darlin. How's that?
Oh, my gosh. I love it. Love it. That's awesome.
See what happens when you let me loose with the production board? Stuff happens.
I know, right? That's awesome. I'm listening to that, and I'm like, ooh, I wonder who he's talking about.
He's talking about you. So this is what I do. So,
like,
you know, I get creative.
Yeah.
This is why I have to listen to a report for several weeks before I get a theme in my head of how to do this. And the hardest part actually is picking the music. But so once I get the music and I get the script, and you obviously know where it came from because you gave me all that information. So then it just became a matter of putting it all together. So that should put you in a good mood. So tell me what's going on.
Very good mood. What's
Black
going
Mama Bear
on
Gun
right
Report.
Now?
I just like saying that.
Right? Right now, honestly, I'm kind of reveling in a meeting that I had last night. I had my Girl in a Gun chapter meeting last night, and I was just blown away because, number one, my classroom was jam-packed, full of ladies. We told them ahead of time what the topic was going to be. It was going to be situational awareness. And my classroom was packed, and these ladies just, they were just sponges. And we talked about all these different types of situations that go on every single day. We used footage from, I'm having a act of self-protection. There we go. We used different footage from there to show different scenarios, and oddly enough, a lot of them happened at gas stations. Do you know that an inordinate amount of attacks happen at gas stations?
No, I believe it, because you're distracted. You're focused. You're staring at your car. You're staring at the tank. You're looking at the price. You're not looking at the person walking around from behind your car. Actually, that makes perfect sense.
And the other thing we noticed, too, is many of these attacks had nothing to do with the person pumping gas. They hadn't even gotten to pumping gas yet. They're messing around in their car. Yeah, they're messing around in their car, or they're fumbling on their phone, or they're headed off, it apparently, like, to the store itself or something like that. But it had very little to do with them actually pumping gas. And
it was very
I found that very interesting, because when I go to a gas station, as soon as I'm out the doors get locked. I'm scanning around me. I immediately go to my gas, putting in my card. I look at the pump long enough to see where the slot is for my card. Other than that, I'm scanning all around me. It's just the mindset, I guess. And I think if someone were looking at me, they'd think I was some kind of nutcase because my head is always on a swivel.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I don't care what they think. But when we were looking at these videos last night, there was one where the lady leaves her car. And like I said, it looks like she's walking to the gas station itself. And she's got her purse down by her side, and this guy comes from the side directly to her. And she doesn't even look at him.
doesn't turn in his direction.
Well, you don't
want
to offend him.
Acknowledge he's there.
Especially if they're a minority person. The white woman doesn't want to offend the minority person by being judgmental.
And that's exactly what the situation was.
Yeah,
and I'm
okay.
For crying out loud, oh, my gosh, just so.
Mm-hmm.
For me as an instructor, as a woman, as a mom, it was just infuriating to watch these videos and to see. Because I would love to take all these people and just put them in a class and be
Do you ever teach
the
dangers of white guilt? I mean, you could do a whole class on the dangers of white guilt. Get a bunch of white women together and say, "Look, you idiots! You know, stop thinking that everything you do is racist. Okay, you're not. Okay, and you'd be the perfect person to teach that class.
No,
I'm serious about that. You could do Candy Pittacard's white racism. You know, white women. You know, anti-racism class. It'd be fascinating because this. No, I'm serious. This really needs to happen. Pianki's probably laughing too. He's on the line as well. Now think about that, because I don't know if anybody's ever done a study of this. How many white victims have there been, or how many white women victims have been victims of Hispanic, Black, Asian, doesn't matter, whatever, simply because they know that the white woman's going to feel guilty and is not going to look up and doesn't want to offend and doesn't want to make eye contact because that would be racist, even though it's not, and then they become victims of crime. I never thought about that till just now, but it's an interesting study, don't
you
think?
It's true.
Pianki, go ahead.
Well,
what do you think? All right. Let's go, Pianki, and then Katie.
In Atlanta, mm-hmm. You know where you have the windshield washers and the young Black males, and they came to this white woman, and she had the guilt, and she let him wash the window, but she didn't have no cash, so she had one of those card deals. What do you call that? Pay app or something. She didn't know how to use it. So she gave it to the young man. And he rang up $1,200 on her.
And took the merchandise, too. Oh, yeah, yeah. Now, this is a big problem. Well, let me ask you another question, Kenny. It's something I was thinking of earlier when you were speaking. Women especially, well, women exclusively on this. Now, men, you know, Pianki and I were raised to naturally be protective, you know, protective of siblings, protective of family, as parents as you get older, protective of, like, girls in school, you know, from you know, the bad boys. We're just naturally raised to be protective, but women aren't. Women are taught to rely on others to defend them. Do you see that as a huge factor in your classes of women and why women are so anxious now to go, you know what, that didn't work for me. You know, I want to learn to defend myself. Do you see that as a big factor?
Okay. So you're going to have to give me a minute on this one. So let's backtrack this for one
second.
Take all
the time you
want.
Yeah. No, that's fine. Yeah.
Let's backtrack for one second. You, mm-hmm. you were kind of half serious, half joking when you mentioned the race thing. To be honest, in my classes with women, I mention it all the time.
Interesting.
But I don't tell them that it's just about race. Honestly, when I'm teaching a basic pistol or when I'm mm-hmm. talking about CCW,
mm-hmm.
I will ask these nice, gentle little white women, are you prepared to shoot a man who is coming after you? Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well,
mm-hmm.
are you prepared to potentially shoot a woman who is coming after you?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if I think she's going to hurt me, yeah. And then I will ask them, are you prepared to shoot a child who is coming after you? Well, and then I'll keep going while they're umming, and I will ask them, as a white woman, are you prepared to shoot a young Black child? Are you prepared to shoot a young Hispanic child? Are you prepared to shoot a young Asian child? And by this time, they're looking at me all confused, and I will tell them, here in America, we're very sheltered. You go somewhere else, hon, the barrel of the gun that you're staring down might not be being held by an adult. It may
be
being held by a child who
yeah.
has been taught, you are an American, you are the enemy, you need to die.
Yeah.
And for a lot of them, that is a rough conversation, because here in America, we're not raised that way. And I'm not going to lie, I thank God that we don't think that way, that that's not how we were. But unfortunately, times are going that direction, and not even because of anything religious or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Look at social media posts, we have roving groups of children killing people, killing homeless people just for the fun of it, for the sport of it. I'm sorry. No religion taught them that. You know what I'm saying?
And they also
culture taught them that.
And also, Candy, in St. Louis, you've had cases where you've had as young as 12 carjacking. And get this, as young as 10 years old carjacking.
Wow. That's
and
scary.
It's just like
isn't
the drug
crazy?
Dealers used to use. It's just like the drug dealers used to use youth to deliver their job because they know that they wouldn't go to jail. So they've figured that out, too, in other areas of criminality, using youth.
Yep. And that's what I tell my ladies, and that is a very difficult pill for a lot of them to swallow. Now, going back to your current statement, what I run into when I'm dealing with ladies, and it is kind of a race issue, when I'm dealing with white ladies, can you load my mag for me? Because my husband does that for me. Can you show me how to rack my slide? My husband always does that for me because he tells me I'm not strong enough. He, you know. So
that's actually a disservice. That is a huge. What, you need to train these husbands.
Oh, dude.
Oh, my
dude,
God.
I know.
Did you call me dude?
So that's. I know, right? You could tell I'm getting frustrated when I break
no,
out.
No, I like
the
it.
Dudes.
No, I love
so,
it. Don't, you're not, so you're not offended. I think it's funny. Dude Greg. Yeah, go ahead.
This is what I see with the Caucasian ladies. Now, when I am dealing with minority ladies, it's more, now I got this gun part. You just show me how to hit the target. You just teach me how to hit
okay,
the target.
Now,
I don't need
any
help
about
with
that.
My gun.
We're breaking some news here. So what is it about black women and Hispanic women that are more independent and why are the white women more dependent on their husbands and why haven't they objected? Didn't they hear about feminism in the 70s? What's wrong with these women? This is fascinating. This may be away from your report and we can get back to your report, but I just find this fascinating. Tell me.
Well, what I see is honestly, what is my show called? The Black Mama Bear Gun Report.
Yeah.
Because that's culturally what we are.
Mm-hmm.
Mothers, minority mothers, black mothers, Hispanic mothers, we tend to be mama bears. And that whole joke about give a Hispanic woman a flip-flop and you will die where you stand, that's it's
what's
true.
A flip-flop?
We,
go, define flip flop for my for those of us that are culturally illiterate. Sorry.
Sandal. It's a shoe apparatus.
So you mean real flip flops? I thought that was slang for something that means something totally different.
Oh no,
okay.
I mean
no, you actually flip flops. I'm sorry.
That,
so you don't give flip flops to Hispanic
joke.
Women? Really? Why is that?
Oh gosh, no, because
help
they will
here.
Beat you senseless with it.
Really?
Oh my gosh, yes. Well, here's the thing. So minority moms, we run the roost. We just do.
Okay.
And our kids know you don't cross mom. There are certain things you don't say, like you're having a slight brain fart and mom calls you and you turn around and say, yeah, or something like that. You're liable to get popped in the mouth before that final syllable comes out. There's a level of respect there when you're dealing with black mothers, Hispanic mothers. And because of that, it's our job to, that's what we do.
Right.
We just do. And if we are blessed enough to have a husband who is the defender of the home, more than likely we're by his side because that's how we roll. We don't trust anybody to take care of our babies but us. That's what
do you ever, this is fascinating. Now, do you ever work with husbands of the women? Do you ever get the guys together in a class and say, especially the guys who are saying, look, you're not helping your wife by racking the slide and loading the magazine for them. They have to be, what if you're not there? And first of all, you shouldn't do that anyway, because that breeds dependence. And the last thing you want to do with self-defense is make a cooperative self-defense. That's not how this works. So do you ever talk to the men and say, look, guys, you're not helping?
Well, yes, I have, because I've had a number of men who have brought their ladies to me for a training, and they will tell me, I'm just going to sit in the back of the room because this is for her. This is not for me. I'm just going to sit in the back of the room, and I'm okay with that because, actually, I love it because if they're in the room, I've got them. And when I bring up, hey, let's load this magazine. Can you show me how? Well, yeah, I can show you how, but you told me you've been to the range before. How did your magazines get loaded then? Well, my husband did it for me. Well, guess what? But he's in the back of the room, and you need this mag loaded, so you best do some figuring out. And by this time, husband's looking up, and you can start seeing the wheels churning a little bit that, yeah, maybe it's not such a good idea that I'm doing everything for her. And I had one lady in particular, she couldn't rack the slide to get the first round in there. And it wasn't that she physically couldn't do it. She was afraid of getting her hand pinched. So apparently she had gone to the range once, racked the slide, and she got her hand caught in it. It pinched her hand. Mm-hmm. So because it pinched her hand once, she never wanted to rack that slide again. So her husband had to do it and blah, 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 blah. And I went, okay, great. Let's see how well that's going to work. So I put her in a scenario. She's in the kitchen cooking. Bad guy kicks in her door. Her gun is right there, but it's not loaded. She's got to rack that slide. So I'm bad guy. I'm coming through the door. She's standing there looking at this gun that needs to be racked. And I said, are you getting my point, hon? Your husband is nowhere around. You have got a perfectly capable firearm right there. You are perfectly capable of protecting, defending yourself, except, oh, yeah, I forgot. The slide's not racked. Come on. How foolish is that? And both she and her husband, after that day, they stopped doing that. They stopped doing that.
Women should go by themselves,
shouldn't
they?
For her.
Yeah.
Well, the husband, instead of doing it for her, he started teaching her how to do it, which is a win-win. That's what I wanted. It's a win-win. I'm not saying exclude the husbands. Oh, my goodness. Heavens, no. But don't crutch your wife. Don't handicap your wife by doing it for her. Help her become more independent and teach her how to do it herself.
Okay. Well, we got to a little bit more for your report, so I'm probably distracted you totally from whatever you want to talk about. So let's get back to your topic.
Oh, dude, I want to talk about whatever you bring up. That's the whole purpose of this.
Well, let me ask you.
Because life is fluid, and I love it.
Yeah, no kidding. Especially on my show. I got John listening for the Women's Firearm Academy report. We'll get him in a little bit. I'll bring him on in just a second. But something I wanted to ask you. Israel. Israel is under attack by Hamas. I heard from Shirley Watchell on our Action Radio gun page, and she used to report for us for I think, almost 2 years, that only 1.5 of Israeli citizens are licensed to carry a firearm. And I thought to myself, first of all, why do they even have why would you have a license in a free country? That's the first question. And the second question is, why is it such a low percentage living next to Gaza, you know, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Jordan? Why are these and having terrorists, you know, crossing the border? How come so few people? And I know we're kind of probably jumping the gun. This may be too early for this conversation, but how come so few Israelis are carrying arms, given that they're surrounded by people that want to kill them? I just found that disturbing.
You know what? I just found that out too, and I'm like you. My jaw hits the drawer. Because I just thought, I mean, you would assume that every person would be armed. Just
right.
What is going on around you, for crying out loud? But it may also be that state of for want of a better word, denial, because they are surrounded by it all the time.
That was a bad joke.
You know, and I don't know, but I would love to know, because my heart goes out for these people.
Yeah.
They're in a horrible situation right now. All of them over there involved in this conflict, they're all in a horrible situation. It's just mine. I don't know.
Well, let's say something interesting that Anthony Blinken said, that every gun group should make a copy of this and broadcast it everywhere. He was in a press conference, I think, yesterday morning with Benjamin Netanyahu, and all they're playing is the quote where he says, "We're the friends of Israel, we'll always be the friends of Israel." But what he started, when I caught it live, he talked about, first of all, he got his street creds by making his connections to the Holocaust. I mean, that's standard American political stuff, and it might be true, I don't know. Probably is. But the point is, he insisted on making that. And then he said something fascinating. He said there are heroes in Israel, like the grandfather that saved his grandkids with a pistol. And I'm thinking, dude, you just justified why there should never be gun control. You just stated it right there. And he go back to the press conference with Benjamin Netanyahu and said, just play that recording over and over. He says, I want to, commend the hero, congratulate the hero, grandfather that saved his grandkids with a pistol. Now, it would be a privately owned pistol, folks, okay? So we're talking privately owned firearms defending against terrorists who showed up with no warning and killed 1,000 people in the most horrible, medieval, biblical, graphic way possible. I mean, this is, I haven't even heard any demands for this, but that you've got to get that recording. You've got to play it. I mean, it just has to circulate among the gun groups. You've got to hear that, because then anytime the left says, well, wait a minute, we need gun control. Well, no, you don't. You just prove that that gun control kills people and that the guns save lives. You even stated it right there. I bet you got called on the carpet for that comment. Did you hear that?
I did not, and I was going to ask you, if you have a link for that, that would be awesome if you could send that
yet.
To me.
I'm busy. You're doing
when,
shows.
When
but
you
just,
do, notice, uh-huh. When you do, please send that to me.
Yeah,
because
well,
I will
you
happily.
Can find it too. Just look up on YouTube the Blinken Netanyahu press conference from yesterday, or the day before.
Okay.
And just as soon as Blinken starts talking, just when he gets past his obligatory reference to his Holocaust, and sure, like I don't want to diminish that. It just seems self-serving and insincere the way he did it. So. That's something. But then he talks about the heroes. That was fascinating. Let me bring John in this conversation to let you guys overlap a little bit. And John, you've been listening for a bit. What do you think of the whole Israel situation and gun ownership?
Oh, I think it's fascinating. It is a definite case for no gun control here. But the 2% thing you talked about, average, 1.5-2%, they have to show a special cause or special need to get a permit. And that permitting process was taking years. Plus,
in
most
Israel?
Of those permits were only
I thought
for
it was like
pests.
Switzerland.
Yeah, in Israel.
Wow, that's
no,
insane.
In Israel. Plus, most of those gun permits were pistol only, and they were limited to 50 rounds.
15 rounds or 50, like magazines? 50
50
per year? 50 rounds
hey,
per
wow.
round? How long?
I don't know how long. I don't know if it was 50 in total for the lifetime or 10. You could replace it with the 10. But the way it was explained to me in the way when I researched it was it was pistols for the most part, and they were limited to 50 rounds.
Candy?
That's
what do you
crazy.
Think?
That I'm speechless.
Yeah, it's pretty
speechless.
Stunning, isn't it?
I can't even wrap my mind around that. I'm sorry. I cannot even wrap my mind around that. Oh, and before we go any further, I wanted to do an asterisk on something I said earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Try to be very, very careful when I'm making blanket statements. So when I'm teaching my class, I do not want you to think that every minority woman that comes in my class is a mama bear, and every Caucasian woman that comes in my class
is a weenie.
Sibling incompetent. No. It crosses over. It truly does. So there is no blanket statement about anyone. Every woman for every couple that walks through my door is brand spanking new to me. They've got a clean slate, and I assume nothing until they give me reason to start making assumptions or start making.
You're thinking
making,
too much.
Yeah,
Andy, you're thinking way too much, you know, and like I make disclaimers too. It happens, you know, but this is the whole point. This is the point of the show. We are the ultimate free speech zone. You can say it. And so if you want to, you know, sort of retract later, that's okay too. I figure three times per show, I say I'm wrong. So, you know, I was wrong about that and that's okay. That's very typical. I got a comment for both of you, you know, from Marco. Marco listens to us in the Netherlands. And of course he can't own a gun because he's in a communist country, you know, and he's in a non-free place. Wow. And so even though it is, I think it's still a monarchy, right? Doesn't it have a Netherlands king? I'm curious about that. Anyway, but the point is that Europe, for the most part, you know, they can't own guns, which is incredible when you think that the French resistance was privately owned firearms, you know, kicked the butt out of the Nazis many times. I think Norway, various other, Poland, they all had resistance. The Greece had a resistance. So they're privately owned firearms in every, you know, pretty much every occupied country in Europe that fought back. And you don't hear about that a lot because it goes against the gun control narrative. So Marco types in, he says, I've never loaded a magazine, but give me one and I'll try and load it. And I'm sure I'll find out how. Well, under stress, yeah. And I was going to type back, you know, you might load the rounds backwards. You might put the magazine in backwards. You know, there's so many things under pressure that you could do wrong. It's hard enough to do. If you look at a magazine and rounds, I don't think most people would figure out which way to put them in. I just, you know, unless they're lucky. Or how to put one on top of the other. Let's go with Candy and then John. What do you think?
Agreed. Especially under stress. Because it's bad enough when you're teaching a new shooter how to load a mag. Once they finally brute force that first round in there, then the second round, you're trying to cram in round thing on top of round thing, and that's a humor story all in itself.
That's a skill.
But if you've got a new shooter trying to do that and under stress, that's a hot mess right there. That is just a hot mess.
You know, it's interesting. I used to do when I worked in a gun store years and years ago, and when the Glocks came out, they were so easy to assemble and disassemble. I do the blindfold thing, put a blindfold on. Of course, I check it first, you know, obviously, even if these were new guns. I take it apart and put it back together in 30 seconds, blindfolded. That's the kind of knowledge you want with your guns. You want to be that intimately aware of them. John, you got police training. John's been was a police officer for years and years. What do you think? What do they teach in the police academies about the stress of, you know, especially if you don't know how to load your guns or you're given an unfamiliar gun? You know, you've got to learn it backwards and forwards.
Yeah, for sure. They spend a significant amount of time on the range. The problem with police training, though, really, too, is it's a static range for the most part. They don't do a ton of stress training with your gun. And that's part of the problem. They'll give you a gun, they'll put you on the range, they'll make sure you're accurate, you can manipulate the gun, you can draw from your holster and present relatively quickly and get your sights on target. But as a general rule, there's not a lot of live fire or even simulated stress training involving your firearm. And that's why I think we see so many police shootings now today, is that they only...
Well, I was
going to
ask you about that. And they also fire all their rounds. You know, you've got situations where they're routinely emptying an entire magazine. These are 15, 17, 18-round magazines. They're not really disciplined. And they don't even know how many shots they fired. And people don't realize that this is the kind of stress. Go ahead. Tell me about that. We're sort of morphing into John's report. John owns the Women's Firearm Academy. So he's the Women's Firearm Academy dude because we're using this word a lot.
Hi,
today.
John.
Hey, Candy, how are you? Hey, does Candy have a minute to stay over? Because I want to run something by her as well.
Candy can stay as long as she wants. I don't care. I love having her on. It didn't matter to me. This is great. Yeah, go ahead, John.
So to backtrack a second before I answer that question, I was going to run something by Candy and get her opinion on as far as the white privilege race kind of issue goes.
Oh, good question.
What we generally talk about speaking is profiling. Profiling for the average person is not a problem. If you've got someone who's basically displaying a behavior, it doesn't matter what their race is. So the classic example is, let's say you have an Arab male, 24 years old, wearing a parka in the middle of summer with wires hanging out of his wrist. It's okay to profile that guy and probably create some space. Where profiling becomes a problem for the public is when law enforcement does it. So if I were to pull over Candy and my first thought is, she's a drug dealer. Once I get to talking to her and I realize she's not a drug dealer, I got to take her out of that drug dealer box and put her in the average person box. where cops get in trouble is they don't take them out of the box and they continue to treat them poorly or bad things happen. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
So
I love it.
So how does that apply from your perspective and what you teach? Is that basically along the same lines? Is essentially it's not about the race, it's about the behavior.
Correct. And that's what I try to teach my ladies. I'm going to steal a quote from an instructor named Shelley Hill. And I love it because she says, when you're out in public, people have a right to be where they are until they don't. So what are they doing that kind of changes that playbook? It's exactly what you just said. You have a right to wear a hoodie and all that good stuff, but when I see wires coming out of the sleeve of that, going to your hand and all that, yeah, now we've got a problem. Yeah, I'm going to start
profiling
you.
I'm not familiar with wires. What does that mean?
The suicide vest.
A suicide bomber. It's implying that this person may have a bomb. But I'm as an average person, I'm not going to notice that. But if I do see that, then, yeah, I'm going to treat you differently. I am going to give you space. I am going to get the flip out of there, and I'm going to get anybody else I care about away from you. Will I confront you? Absolutely not. But am I going to hang around and see, gee, I wonder what those wires are for? No, I'm not going to do that. I'm out of there. So I agree with you, and this is what I tell my ladies. Just because you see something doesn't mean you jump into Wonder Woman mode and decide that you're going to address it. No, but you do respond appropriately, and for a lot of us, that appropriate response is to get the heck out of there.
Yeah, but let me, at the risk of revealing, I don't think this is classified information, otherwise I wouldn't tell you what I'm about to tell you. But from training I have had, they ran a scenario with a suicide bomber. And it was law enforcement, and everybody was like, you know, yelling, freeze, stop, don't do anything. And of course, the suicide bomber blew up their vest. John, you can confirm. Jonathan, I've been talking to him for years. John, you can confirm this. I'm sure that if you shoot a bomb and take out a terrorist, that bomb is not likely to go off. It has to be a fuse. It has to have a detonator, have something like that. So in other words, people are afraid of shooting somebody wearing a suicide vest with explosives. You know, you're not going to set off the explosives by shooting the person to stop them from detonating the bomb that they're wearing. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Have you heard anything
about
that?
No, you're not. But the problem you're going to have, though, is if you don't turn that light switch off instantly, the sympathetic movement he's going to have after that gunshot is going to release that detonator.
Right. That's
correct.
If they're holding it, though, and this may be more detail than people, can do. So if there's nowhere to run, if you're in an enclosed room, okay, let's make a worst-case scenario. So you're in the gas station, and the suicide bomber walks into, the lobby of the gas station. There's nowhere out. There's only one door out of there.
Sure.
How do you stop that person? If you're an armed citizen, how do you stop that person? What's that?
Sure. Shot placement is always more important than caliber. We talk about this all
correct.
The classes. It's your shot placement is going to be far more important than the caliber of your gun. Now, there's only one spot on your head where you can shoot somebody and basically take out their brainstem, which is going to shut them down instantly. So they won't have any sympathetic movement or parasympathetic movement after that shot. But you've got to know where that is, and you've got to know how to hit it. And generally, it's not the forehead.
So let's reveal it so people know, because we're in an era now where Hamas, you could be in this country. There is no reason to think that we wouldn't have suicide bombers or terrorist activity based on the fact that Brandon's let in 15 million illegals and they have no idea who these people are. This may be a scenario in this country. So let's deal with it. So let's talk about that, because I don't think you're revealing anything that the terrorists don't already know. So let's hear the story. Hold on, Piaki. Hold on. I want to get an answer to this first of all. John?
Yeah, your best spot is right through the nose.
Right through the nose.
Hit him right through the nose.
Okay.
Right? That's going to give you a direct line basically to their brainstem and their pons, and then their pons, and that'll shut them down. Right.
So like bridge or anywhere there?
Anywhere in that area.
Center of the face?
You've got enough leeway in that area, you'll hit it, especially with expansion on your rounds. But the problem's like the head in general, the skull. The skull's pretty hard. If you hit that thing at any kind of angle, a lot of times it'll either ricochet or it'll just travel. It'll penetrate the skin but not the bone, and it'll just travel right around the scalp line and come out the back.
Yeah. I've heard 380s bouncing off skulls when they hit an angle, especially the forehead. You know, there's a story of that someone who was, people don't hear about that.
We're back to shot placement.
Right.
Yeah, we're back to shot placement, though. You can do it with a 22.
Okay.
Right? You can, 22s, for people, a 22 on up is you're going to be pretty effective if you put the shot in the right place.
Right.
You got to know where the right place is.
Well, now we know.
You
got to
know where
know
the
that.
Right place is, and you've got to be trained. You've got to train because under stress, you're going to default to your lowest performance level.
Right.
And if you consistently train, hopefully that's going to be second nature to be able to get that gun out and get those rounds on target. However, if you're that once a year because, this is a fun thing to do, chances are when the moment is there, you're going to miss the mark. You just are. The head is an extremely small target. We're making it even smaller by giving you a specific area, and chances are good it's going to be moving around. If you have not practiced precision shooting under stress, under a timer, small area.
Moving targets.
Not going to happen. Yes, moving target. It's not going to happen. And unfortunately, I think a lot of people skill level.
Right.
By far. They think that they're going to magically pull these skills out of somewhere simply because the situation calls for it. And I'm here to tell you that's not going to happen.
No,
not
just the opposite.
Happen.
Yeah.
Yep.
Let's get Pianki's question. Now, I think we're on to a very interesting topic here. Pianki?
Yeah, suicide bombers carry in their hands a double position, double drill switch. So when they push down on the button, his arm, and if they die, they lose muscle control, we release it and switch and the bomb goes off. The best thing for that is don't be around the people that they're targeting, and hopefully they're not targeting you.
No, and I'm saying 99% of the time the best thing is get out of there. But I'm saying if you're cornered, if there's no other choice, it's nice to have at least one possible option that might work. If I have a choice, if I know I'm going to die, I'm going to take that chance. If that's the situation I'm in, I'm going to take that shot. But if not, I'd love to get away. It's like a fight. Do I want to fight? No. Even if I was the best martial artist in the world, I'd still rather walk away because nobody wins. It's just who loses less. John, back to you. What do you think?
Yeah, so this kind of leads to Candy's point as well about are you willing to do what you have to do? And there's that hesitation. Mm-hmm. If you're in that situation, you hesitate. It's just as bad as missing the shot.
Yeah.
And that's you can't have that self-doubt and you can't have that hesitation. There's always three fights. There's the mental fight, the legal fight, and the physical fight.
Okay, let's
if
go through.
If you hesitate on
this
any three, if you hesitate on three. Well, physical fight, you have to win for anything else to matter. Right? If you're dead, it doesn't matter.
Right.
The mental fight is if you don't think about this up front and you can't live with what you're about to do or have done, it doesn't do you any good to be so damaged. You're either no use to yourself or your family, and God forbid you end up killing yourself over it.
Right.
One of my instructors who taught me to be an instructor for the NRA, he was teaching a class. He had a 20-something-year-old truck driver come through, get his concealed carry, pass his class, goes out in his truck. Month later, a guy attacks him in his truck, and he has to shoot him. 100% justified. The guy came in with a crowbar, brushed his window, broke his window, and attacked him inside the truck, fired one round, the guy ended up dying.
Mm-hmm.
Problem was, 30 days later, the kid committed suicide because he couldn't live with it. Not my instructor's fault, but it's a horrific story. And it's a good story for people to think about, because if you can't live what you have to do or with what you've just done, that's a loss.
And we always need classes for people that have defended themselves. Do we have any, and we always think about beforehand, but does Candy or John, do you offer classes for people, like even the support group of people that had to defend their life, either they injured or killed their attacker, which was the right thing to do. They did everything right, but they're still having huge things. In this case, it led to suicide. What do you do for the people that have had to defend themselves? Let's go John first.
Well, we actually talk to a lot of people like that. We field a ton of phone calls from people that have had issues or had problems, and we just talk to them in general.
Okay.
The biggest thing we do, though, is we've got a mental class, a mental preparedness class, So you can put that work in up front so you don't have to get damaged on the back end. If we add some prevention into the process, then you don't have as many hurt individuals afterward. And that's, they don't do that for cops. They don't do that for the military, and they really should. They don't talk about what your mind and body are going to do under stress. Under stress, you become a physically different person. Cortisol and adrenaline dumps changes you chemically.
Right.
But if you don't realize that, and you don't realize some of the things that come along with it, tunnel vision, auditory exclusion, all kinds of different things, right? Time warps, time slows down, time goes faster. People tend to think they're crazy. And then if you have memory loss on top of that, and they can't factor that in or understand why it happened, they start to doubt themselves and their actions. That's our primary focus. We talk to people all the time that have been through those incidents. And we talk a lot about those incidents in class and how people dealt with them and how to avoid some of those pitfalls. So that's kind of our focus.
Interesting. Candy, what do you think?
I think I'm loving what I'm hearing that you guys offer. Unfortunately, I personally don't offer that because that's outside my wheelhouse. However, were I approached by someone in that situation, I do have resources available to reach out to, and I would, for want of a better word, I would pass them along to those who regularly deal with this, because I do not. I'll be honest, I feel very blessed that I haven't had to deal with this. However, I do know that these people need help, and I want to be able to provide that for them, even if it's not from me.
Yeah. You two should get together and go to each other's, you know, academies and classes and do like a joint class. I could just see you two teaching a really good class together because you come from very different backgrounds. This would be interesting.
I think it'd be fun. Yeah, I would love it.
Well, okay. Well, you're on the gun page. You know, talk to each other. I'll get you in contact with each other. But this would be interesting. Here's another question, and Pianki could probably relate to this too, because we're both pilots. I was a flight instructor, and I hope to teach again. I've kept my certificate current just for that purpose. But I've been tested. The people that are in life defense situations, you know, they've been tested. John, I'm sure you've been tested. Candy, I'm sure you've been tested. I've handled emergencies in the air, you know, simple things. The gear wouldn't come down. You know, the engine failed. That was interesting. Lost radios in the clouds, lost instruments in the clouds. That was really interesting. And some, you know, potentially life-ending situations. And I do pretty well in terms of being calm. It's like I think about it. I go into, like, rational mode. I get very calm, very cool, very matter-of-fact, very, okay, what do I need to do? Where's the checklist? Let's deal with this. And I almost go into, like, a robot mode. So I've been through, you know, life-endangering situations in the air. And so I know what I'm going to do. And I think I can relate that to a, you know, a self-defense situation. At least I hope so. And those things didn't affect me personally, other than the fact that I went, oh, just don't do that again, you know, but because I acted, as far as I was concerned, correctly. And obviously I'm still here and my students are still here. So, you know, whatever we did worked. Do you find that people who have been tested maybe in other areas of life, facing life-ending situations, are better able to handle a life-ending self-defense situation? Curious. Ooh, I've stumped the panel. Who wants to go first?
No, I just didn't know if you wanted who wanted to go first.
No, it's okay. When I stop talking, that's your cue. I'll say over. Okay. How's that? Over. John, your turn.
Fair enough. We're still polite here.
You guys, most people just jump right in. You know, they're not as polite as you two. So, anyway,
go ahead.
John, what do you think?
Yeah, generally speaking, I think that's true as a general rule. But I also think it can be specific to your talent or your education or your background.
Mm-hmm.
Being a pilot is going to lag because of those things you experience in the air will make it easier in life in general to deal with those stressful mm-hmm. situations.
Yeah.
I think as a general rule, it's true. But I also think that because you're an instructor, because you went through the background, because you had flight time, because you went through the training and educated mm-hmm. yourself, that was a massive benefit to you. So it's the work up front that you did that allowed you to be calm in the actual when the incident occurred. And that's kind of what we talked about with the three fights. If you understand that there are three fights, if you have the experience and background physically, you have the experience and background mentally and legally, you're less likely to hesitate, and you're more than likely to survive the incident on all three fronts.
Hmm. I had a little background noise from one of you, so just mute yourselves if you want to make noise, if you're making coffee or, you know, dogs barking or things like that, so three. But that's interesting. John, did we cover all three? It's the physical fight, the mental fight. What's the mental fight? I think we covered that. It sounds like more like PTSD than anything else. And what was the third one? The legal fight.
The legal.
Let's cover that.
Yeah, so if you don't know self-defense law and what's legal and what's not legal and if you're inside the bounds or not, there's that hesitation again. Mm-hmm. So we talked to a lot of people about, okay, here's a scenario, and the first question is, well, I don't know if that's legal or not, so I don't even know if I can do it.
Hmm.
And if you have that hesitation and you're worried about getting sued or going to prison, it doesn't help.
Yeah, it's like concealed carry holders. Because I remember when I was new to, in fact, I wrote an article, I'm going to republish it on Substack, you know, to carry a gun. And my first thought as a new concealed carry holder, because I left the communist state of California and came to Florida, got myself a permit. Of course, now you don't need one. But the first thought everybody has is, oh, no, they might see that I'm carrying a gun. They're not worried about the criminals. They're not worried about the life, you know, ending situations. They're not worried about having to defend themselves or people around them. They're worried that somebody's going to see that they're carrying a gun, and that's going to be embarrassing, awkward, or something like that. That seems to be the biggest fear of people. So you want to talk about the mental and the legal? There's a perfect example. Without even being a life-ending, you know, ending situation potentially, you're already embarrassed or feeling awkward just for the fact that you're carrying a gun for the first time. John?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. And then if you don't understand the five core elements of self-defense, how to apply them, let alone your specific area, that's that hesitation, especially in today's society, right? Mm-hmm. You're far more likely to get prosecuted now than you were 50 years ago.
Right.
But, you know, our job as instructors really should be to educate you and to build your defenses now so mm-hmm. you look really hard to prosecute. And if you set yourself up, we talk a lot about police interactions. How do you interact with them? Do you interact with them? We talk about interacting with the attorney, how the court system works. But we also cover the core principles that will apply, you know, universally to self-defense, and then break it down to, you know, Montana specifically, because that's where we're here, and mm-hmm. how that law applies. The problem you're going to have is when you have that doubt or you don't understand the law, there's your hesitation, and there's the problem again.
You can get killed worrying if what you're doing is legal. Someone's facing you with a knife or
right.
a gun, and you think, can I legally defend myself? You're already dead. You know, you could be, you know, worrying about something that you can take up in court later. You know, ha. Candy, let's get you on this. All right, go ahead, John. This is your report.
So last week when Pianchi asked about shooting the guy who stole his gun and running away.
Uh-huh.
That's not going to be legal if he's running away with your gun and not doing anything else.
Right.
Right. So it's a question of can I, should I, but it's also is legal or not legal.
Mm-hmm.
And you hear that a lot, especially in our classes, is, you know, if the guy comes to my house, can I shoot him? Well, you can, but should you? Yeah, maybe not.
Yeah.
What if it's that drunk neighbor who thinks it's his house? What if it's, you know, the kid?
I know of a case like that.
His girlfriend's bedroom.
I know some of that happened too.
Well,
yeah, yeah.
I have a very specific case because we had a lady come through class last month, and new gun owner, lives by herself. About 2 weeks before she came to class, she heard someone in her house about 2 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it terrified her, and she didn't know what to do. So eventually she mustered up some courage to go downstairs and check it out.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of issues with that, we're not going to get into that. But it turned out to be her college-age daughter. Yeah, it turned out to be her college-age daughter sneaking into the house to surprise her.
Oh, geez. Yeah, yeah.
Had she have had a gun, had she have operated under terror and panic and pulled that trigger, maybe justified, but she could never live with herself.
No.
Right.
And this is the decision. This is why I think one of the biggest problems is law enforcement comes bursting through. You don't know if they're actually law enforcement or not. It could be a home invasion. You have to make a decision. If you hesitate and it's a home invader, they may kill you. If you threaten and it's law enforcement, they may kill you. Either way, you could end up dead because you're half asleep and you're groggy. And how do you make that decision? There's a lot. We talked about this before. There's some serious problems as far as that goes. You know, I would think the police, you know, stop doing these midnight raids. You know, wait, you know, come in the daytime so we can see what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, it would be more worth it or get people in the place where you know they're going to be. Or just like you said before, surround the house. Say, okay, we're here. You're not going anywhere. You know, just calmly think about it. Take your time. We'll be fine, but you ain't going anywhere. You know, I mean, there's so many ways that the police could handle this, especially the FBI could handle this better. We only got a few minutes left. I got my next guest actually already online, so we'll see if Jenna wants to join our conversation here in a bit. John, did you have a report today? Because we sort of hijacked your report. It's been kind of fun.
No, it's okay. Did Candy have a comment on that? I didn't want to cut off.
Candy, yeah, go for it. Candy?
Actually, I did have a comment on it. And, again, for me, it just comes down to training. Because knowing what you can and cannot do, yeah, that's called training, guys. Knowing what's legal, knowing what's not legal. Because I agree with you. I hear so many people in class, well, yeah, but was it, I mean, how big was the knife? And will I get into trouble because I pulled out a gun on a guy who had a knife and da-da-da-da-da, and I'm just thinking, okay, hon, all those questions that you're worrying about, you wouldn't have time to worry about them because you'd be dead. So yeah. You need to work on this stuff, learn this stuff, know this stuff long before that should I bring a gun to a knife fight day arrives.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so important that you know, no, you cannot shoot someone in the back even though he took your gun. No, you can't do that.
No, you call 911, report your gun stolen. You know, they got your gun registered anyway, so, you know, that's what you do.
Supposedly shooting crazy. Over their shoulder.
No, see, I'm with John and Candy on this. The only time you can shoot is when someone's a threat facing you, coming towards you, or presenting a deadly weapon. If, you know, if they're pointing a gun at you, I mean that's a no-brainer. Okay, but running away with your property, running away with your 63 Corvette. What happened?
Yeah, that happened in Atlanta at the Jack in the Box. A guy was running away and he put his gun over his shoulder and shot at the police officer.
So that's different.
So they had to fire
that's
back.
Justified. Yeah. See, so it's not the fact that he's running away that counts. It's the fact that he pointed a gun at you. So whether he's facing you or
correct.
Facing away from you, it doesn't matter.
Agreed. That's the whole thing. If you're shooting at me, you are a threat. I don't care if you are upside down, swinging mm-hmm. from the ceiling with your back to me. If you are shooting at me, you are a threat. I can yeah. legally respond to that threat. But if you took a gun and you're running away from me and you're not doing anything to me, I legally cannot shoot you. I can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I'm going to go back to what Candy originally started with, which is situational awareness, because I want John's opinion on this, too, and then I'll bring Jen in the conversation. When I go drive to a gas station, the first thing I do is look at all the customers. And I look at all, like, the homeless guy sitting there, you know, in the corner, and I look at, you know, is there a gang here? I mean, I immediately look. And if I don't like the situation, I go to another gas station. So I do what Kenny does, and I'm sure John does that too. Because that's always an option. So as you're driving in, you know, the first question is, do you want to pump gas here? You know, and if I see, you know, 10 members of gang, you know, wearing colors or whatever it is, you know, I'm not going to stay there. But even if I just don't like the situation, I feel there's a bad vibe. I don't like the homeless guy. It looks like he's hiding a gun under his jacket and staring at me. I'm still going to leave. I don't care. It doesn't matter. But I mean, because I learned this from flying too, but I learned this just from my own, you know, self-defense is that situational awareness is so important. So many things can be avoided if you just look around. If you see a bunch of people at the gas station, you know, who don't look good, don't go there, you know, or someone pulls into the gas station. Okay, I've got enough fuel. I'm leaving. Thank you. Yeah, you know, so let's get to Candy. Do that again, then, John, then I'll bring Jenna in and see if she wants to talk about this.
That was pretty much it for me. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
that was pretty much it for me is just you need to train. You need to train. And, yes, watching videos about scenarios and how they should be addressed. Yeah, that's a form of training too. Training doesn't always have to be putting rounds down range. It doesn't have to be. It's educating yourself. It's talking to people. It's knowing the laws. It's asking those pressing questions. Can I do this? It's all of that is, to me, falls under the umbrella of training. And it's absolutely mandatory if you are going to be carrying around a firearm or depending on one to potentially save your life.
Yeah. John, situational awareness, I mean, that's a whole topic unto itself. We're talking about
awareness and voice is where everyone should start. That should be the beginning of everybody's training. Understanding awareness,
agreed.
Understanding avoidance, that should work. Before you pick up a gun, before you do anything else, that's going to solve 90% of your problems up front.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's where you should be. Your gas station scenario is great, but I would take it a step further. If you're at the gas station and it looks fine, so you start pumping gas, but something shows up in the middle of that, it's okay to stop pumping gas and move on.
Yeah.
And that's where most people get stuck. It's like, well, I got gas. Like, I need to finish getting my gas. No, you don't really need to finish getting your gas. You already prepaid it. Take the pump out, stick it in the thing, drive off.
Yeah, go.
It's okay. It's okay to leave. We're blessed in this country that we've got a gas station like every other block and a grocery store between them. You've got options. You don't have to put yourself in a bad situation just because you think you need to be there or because you're already there.
Yeah, and don't do the racism thing.
Agreed.
Just think if you're a different race than all the other people in the gas station, think, well, I think I'm going to go pump gas here because, you know, I don't want to, you know, appear to be a racist. You know, we talked about that earlier in the show too. This is fascinating stuff. I love going into this. Let's bring Jenna in, who probably, I don't know, you know, what she might think of this or not. We're going to talk about the book she wrote with Pierre Corey on the war on ivermectin in the next hour. So, Jenna, do you want to get in this conversation? Do you have any comments or questions for either Candy or John or our gun experts? This is like Friday Gun Day.
Yeah, just throw me right under the bus.
I do that.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
I do that all
me.
The time. This is Action Radio. Take action.
You don't have to have action.
And you don't have to have a question. That's okay. I just, you know, because you're here. I figured I love to have people cross over in fields that they might never have thought about. So here you are.
Yeah. No, I have a thought about everything, Greg. I mean, that's just who I am. But, I was listening to you thinking I'm from New York. Born, you know, in the city. I lived there again in my 20s. Now I live in Austin, and my kids were not raised in the city, but my youngest daughter just moved to New York, Manhattan, like 2 months ago. And when we dropped her off, we just kept repeating over and over again, head on a swivel, head on a swivel. Just be aware at all times. At all times, if you think you're safe, like, you know, when we're on the subway, I'm like, your back is to the wall. You don't stand against the tracks. You're not the first one on, and you're, you know, like, absolutely, situational awareness. It's everything because, you know, especially I'm thinking about this, you know, this city situation. Like, if you're the one walking with, you know, your earphones in, looking down at your phone, like, I'll mess with her. She'll just be standing on the subway track looking at her phone, and I'll come up with my hand underneath it and pop it out. Like, do you see how fast I can get that hand? Just be aware. Always be aware.
What's she doing in New York
scary,
these days? But, I mean, talk about situational awareness. You've got a situation. You've got liberals. You've got illegals. You've got looters. You've got no judiciary. You've got the police can't do anything. You've got liberal Soros DAs. Why would you go to New York at this particular time? I'm not accusing you. I'm just curious.
Let me tell you something. You know, you and I are on the same page. Like, there's so much propaganda in the world. Oh, New York is a hellhole. I have been there my entire life on and off. It is no different than it ever was. It's not.
Okay.
Like,
good to know.
Canal Street is still creepy and seedy. The Upper West Side is still lovely and bougie, and the park is still the park. There's homeless people and there's families. Like, I don't feel any different about her being there than I did when I moved there as an adult in the 90s. Like, I really don't. And frankly, she's a model. That's where she needs to be. She walked in.
Well, yeah, that's true.
You know, she won't be there forever. She'll be in other big cities too. But don't
Paris.
Believe everything you see. Don't believe everything you see.
Okay. Well, that's really good to know. Let's get your information because we haven't even got your contact stuff. Then I'm going to go to Jenna. Of course, we got Pianchi, we got Candy, we got John. I want to talk to Jenna for a whole bit, but I'll bring on questions a little bit later if you guys are still on the line. But John, let's get your contact stuff, and then I'm going to introduce Jenna properly.
Yeah, sure, no problem. We're at Women's Firearm Academy.com, and the phone number is 406-318-7233, and that's about all I got. One last thing, though. For everybody out there, if you decide to use force to defend yourself, two things happen automatically. You've got a greater chance than zero of being injured or killed, and you've just surrendered your fate to other people, meaning your fate is in the hands of law enforcement, a prosecutor, and the court. That's why avoidance is important. That's why awareness is important. Because you no longer have control of what happens in your life the minute you decide to defend yourself. You need to be prepared on all three fronts.
Interesting. This is why both of your reports are so valuable. Candy, let's get your contact information. And then I'm going to mute everybody just because that way you can make background noise and we'll be fine. And I'll bring you in a little bit later if you're still here. Candy, how do folks reach you?
I am Candy Petticord. I am with North Point Training, LLC. I am also a Girl in a Gun chapter facilitator for Akron, Ohio, North Coast, and Stark and Summit counties. So you can reach me there, and you can find me on shootingclasses.com.
There we go. So there's your next book, Jenna.
Yeah.
I can research. I know people. I'm in radio. It's pretty cool. All right. Take care of everybody. Let's get to Jenna here and introduce her as our guest of the day. Jenna McCarthy. So Jenna was introduced to me by a friend and fellow activist, Laura Bartlett, who does ourpatientrights.com. In fact, she was on Tuesday with both Naomi Wolf and Dr. Judy Mikovits, which is pretty incredible. Anyway, Jenna co-wrote The War on Ivermectin with Dr. Pierre Corey, who was also on the show during our 18-week World's Greatest Doctors panel last year. So I know all their stories, but what I don't know is Jenna's story. So Jenna, welcome to Action Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Well, good. Let me quickly scroll down here. Where is it? Where is it? Here we go. A round of applause.
That's my love language. That's my love language. I love recognition and props and kudos.
Well, we're pretty friendly here. I mean, this is, again, it is the ultimate free speech zone. Now, I was trying to learn, you know, a bunch of stuff about you. And you sent me an article, which I was able to read a little bit of before the show today. But things have been – this has been an unbelievable week with national figure guests. It's been pretty incredible. But I want to find out about you because I'm curious. So let's get your story. So you write books. You co-author books. You write them yourself. What's your specialty?
A little bit of everything. So I have a publishing background. As I was saying on the other topic, I'm from New York. I lived in New York. I worked in publishing. I was on staff at many magazines. And then I started a freelance career 25 years ago. And then, of course, as you do, that segues into books. So I've ghostwritten books.
Right.
I've written 18 books of my own. Unlike some authors where, you know, they pick a genre and they stick with it, they're a crime writer or a thriller or, you know, romance, whatever it is, I have literally done everything. I have written memoir, nonfiction, fiction, middle grade fiction, children's picture books, medical expose, a little bit of everything. So
romance
prior
novels?
To COVID,
come on, tell me. You write romance
no,
novels?
No, actually not romance. Although apparently that's where
she
the money
looks
is.
She looks deep
so
into her eyes with wanting, wanton pleasure. She stared up saying,
I will
saying,
tell you, I have a lot of author friends. And when 50 Shades of Grey came out and it was so successful, I had so many friends going, we could do this. Like, it's so bad. We could absolutely. And we tried and we're like, I can't do this. It's so cringy. I can't. So I that is the one genre, thank you for pointing out to me, that is never going to happen, even under a pseudonym. Like, I have a friend who writes a lot like I do, and she's like, we could just pick a pen name. And we just, like, whatever. It'll be embarrassing, but we'll do it. And we tried and we were like, nope. Not happening. So
can't do it.
Which is probably a blessing.
How about a
yeah.
comedy romance?
So,
how about a comedy romance? You know, maybe we'll combine
I have
genres.
Done some of that. I have done
We'll
some
do like
of
a political romance, you know, make it a comic thing. This possibilities are endless. You know, we're creative here. That's what we do. Okay.
Well, our political scene is like a tragic comedy right now. So we've
oh,
got
no
that
kidding.
To entertain us. We've got that.
Yeah, I have enough
so,
fun
yeah,
with that.
So I'm a writer.
Go ahead.
I am a wordsmith. You know, I'm not, let's be clear. I'm not a doctor. I'm not a scientist. I'm the butt of every internet meme because I came to be where I am today by, wait for it, doing my own research, right? That's what I was doing. That's what, you know,
oh, listen,
like, I'm sure you've seen the meme of, you know, there's, it's like a split screen. So on one side, there's a doctor in scrubs and underneath it, it'll say, you know, 8 years of medical school plus 17 years of residency. And on the other side, it's a woman, you know, me sitting on the toilet on her phone. And underneath it, it says, does her own research. Like, you know, they make fun of it, but it's like, I'm researching doctors. I'm not researching, you know, made up
well,
stuff
this is fascinating.
In fairyland.
This is fascinating. I used to have a liberal caller that said, are you a doctor? I said, no, but I can read the studies. I said, I've read the Dr. D.D.R.O. study on chloroquine. I know exactly what it is, how it works, and I know that it cures COVID.
Yeah.
So I don't have to be a doctor to do that. You know, my famous line is, you know, I'm not a meteorologist, but I know when it's raining. So, you know.
That's a good one.
You can use
That's
that. The other
one
that
yeah,
I heard
but,
online.
I mean,
yeah. Uh-huh. Go ahead.
I mean, this was kind of a point that we make, which I haven't even gotten to the book yet, The War on Ivermectin, but we make
we'll
this book
there.
All the way through.
Yeah,
that,
we got an hour.
You know,
so,
when they couldn't attack the science, when they could no longer attack the science, when the science around ivermectin was so irrefutable, what else can they do? They attack the source, right? So then it becomes the conspiracy theory. You get that label, you get the right wing nut job, you know, you get all the things where it's like, well, don't listen to anything that guy says. He's saying ivermectin is legit. Well, but he's a conspiracy theorist. It's right there in his Wikipedia page. I mean, it's absurd.
Yeah, exactly, which is always a story. See, we don't use the term conspiracy theory here. We call them ongoing investigations.
Yeah.
Of course, you're a wordsmith. You'd appreciate that. We rename everything. The GOP is the gelding old party. Rhino Republicans are transgender Democrats. You can use that one. You know, I mean, Dr. Fascist, I haven't used his name in probably 2 years. He's Dr. Fascist, the genocidal, psychopathic, avaricious, narcissistic, pathologically lying, vaccine drug pusher. That's his full title.
Oh,
you can use that too.
That's
you
a
like
good
that one?
One.
Yeah, I'll write it down.
That is a really good one.
Get the podcast. Yeah. But I wanted to establish your writing creds before we got into the book, because a lot of people know Pierre Corey, and they're not as familiar with you, and that includes me, you know, mea culpa. So I'm really glad that I got to introduce you. Let's explore the writing a little bit more before we get in the book, because do we have you for the full hour just to make sure? Yes?
We do. You have me until 9:59.
Okay, good. So in that case, so that I'll be brief that last at 9:58, I'll start talking really fast.
Okay.
Ghostwriting. There's a large amount of people that actually don't write their own books. I mean, I wrote my book, the Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. I write all my own articles. I don't have a ghostwriter. I do research, except for the reporters that do their research. Everybody here does their own research. You know, we're old school. You know, I don't take PR points from people that, you know, I have folks that I work with that give us, you know, all kinds of national, you know, guests. But, you know, I've had PR firms say, well, here are the talking points and here are the questions you're going to ask. I'm like, are you kidding? You got the wrong host here, you know. So ghostwriting, to me, that would be embarrassing. You should be listed as the author, you know, a book, you know, suggested by, you know, some famous person or a book about a famous person. But they can't say that if you're a ghostwriter, you're the one's actually doing the writing. Why aren't you the main person on that book? Just curious.
So I've ghostwritten one book, and it was my first book. And I was approached to do this because the quote-unquote author was a dear friend, and she was a celebrity, and she had the book deal. They came to her and they said, we would like to write a book about you, and you know, in your voice. And she was like, I'm not a writer. And they said, that's okay. We'll put a writer on it. They'll interview you and you'll tell your story. And she was like, my best friend's a writer and nobody's better than her. I want her. And they said, we don't care. We'll pay anybody you want. So I only did that because it was my best friend and because I kind of needed to go through that process. I'd been threatening to write a book. This was 20 something years ago, but I'd been threatening to write a book
and I
hadn't done it. And now I had a paycheck, you know, I had a reason, and we knocked it out of the park. The reviews were great, but I will tell you, the ego in me reading the reviews that were like, wow, we never knew she was such an amazing, she's so great with words and all this stuff. And I'm like, how can you? And she would go on, as you have to, she would go on talk shows and talk about the process of writing the book. And it killed me. It literally killed me inside. It would be like, you know, whoever actually sang for Milli Vanilli having to watch them take credit. You know, like, no, those are my words. Those are my, I gave her my stories, things that happened to me in my lifetime, and I gave them away. And I swore after that, I was like, all right, I've been through the process. I know how to do this. I will not do it again. So I have been approached many, many times to ghostwrite. I'm like, nope, I will co-write. I need my name on that book. I need my name on the marquee. I need it is my voice. So with this book, and you know, the beauty of co-writing a book too, is that like all the books I've written by myself, it's really hard to self-promote. It's hard to go out on interviews and say, this book is so amazing. It's so great. You're really going to love it. But if I write a book with you, I can brag about Pierre all day long. I can brag about the information in that book and how beneficial and important it is. I'm just the wordsmith, right? I just made it sound good. I just made the decisions of, you know, how to craft it into a narrative and what to get rid of and what to, you know, really highlight. So, you know, I'm the stylist, but you're the model. You were already pretty when you came to me. I just made you look a little bit better.
You see, I think of ghostwriting as a copyright violation because a co-author is one thing. That's different. This is where I want to kind of go from that when you mentioned it into how you met Pierre and how this all got started. But if you're doing the work, you know, if someone actually stole your work and put their name on it, you know, that's that would be a copyright violation. But yeah. as we call it plagiarism, right? Something that Joe Biden is famous for. But if you ghostwrite a book, now you're paid for it. Somehow that takes away the copyright right that you have. And I've never understood that. I don't believe in ghostwriters.
It's co-authors, a contractual obligation. Like you agree in the contract, I am going to be your voice. I am going to tell your story. This is what I get in exchange for it. I do not get credit. I mean, it's excruciating. I mean, I have lots of friends. I have a friend, a close friend from my New York days who wrote probably 15 books. And then she was asked to ghostwrite Snooki. Remember Snooki from Jersey Shore?
Not really. Barely.
Okay.
I never watched it either. Catch my attention.
Super
I watched like
reality.
Trial films. You know, things like that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I mean, it's cheesy, embarrassing reality TV. But she did, and it became a bestseller. And, you know, the conflict in that between, God, I've written all these really good books that people won't know about just because the publishing industry is so competitive. Publishers only really promote and support the folks who are already making the money, the Grishams, whoever it is, the little people. They're like, yeah, we'll throw you a couple peanuts. But
I have a book.
You kind of have to
Hello.
Make.
I wrote
yeah,
one.
Yeah, well, yeah,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah,
it's
I
hard.
Do know.
It's a yeah. hard, it's a hard gig.
Yeah.
So no more ghostwriting for me is what I'm saying.
No, that makes perfect sense. See, I would abolish ghostwriting and just make it co-authors because it really is your work, you know, and it should be equal pay, equal billing, equal everything because you wrote it, you know. And so that's any other time that would be called plagiarism. All right, let's go. So how did you meet Pierre Corey? And let's talk about who he is. So who's he? And then we'll talk about how you met.
Pierre is a rock star. He is like my has become my best friend brother in the year that we've worked together. He's fantastic. So he is a critical care specialist, a physician. He is a pulmonary expert. He has a fascinating medical background, which we cover in the
pulmonary
book.
Pulmonary is heart, right?
But also
just so folks know,
kind of
pulmonary is heart.
A late bloomer. You know, didn't really, wasn't sure what he was going to do and kind of waffled around for a while. But he's brilliant. He's like the nutty professor brilliant. He's so smart. He has to get out of his own way sometimes. if he hears a statistic once, he knows it for the rest of his life. You know, I'm trying to interview him for this book and the numbers he's throwing out. I'm thinking to myself as I'm taking notes, I'm like, yeah, I'm going to check that. That doesn't sound right. The man was never wrong. He was never wrong. It's insane.
Recording. So, did you record him or did you just take notes? Because notes, you tend to miss things, I would think.
Oh, I just take notes. No, I can type faster than you talk. Like I can be typing what you're saying
faster
and
than I talk?
Typing out my next question. Yeah.
That's pretty
it's
good.
It's crazy. I've been doing this for a long time. I'm like a musician. Like I really can. I transcribe conversations all day long with my fingers. It's a little bit of a sickness. But again,
interesting.
I've been doing it a long time.
You could take our chats here and make a. Actually, I'm hoping to make a book. We did 18 weeks of the World's Greatest Doctor panel, which Pierre Corey called in on. But the regular panel was Judy Mikovits, Brian Artis, Ben Marble in the beginning. Jim Thorpe was here. All a lot of the biggies. Pierre joined us. Christiane Northrup joined us. Tiffany Prado, the marketing genius, joined us, and a bunch of other folks. I got a whole list of doctors that joined us. It's an incredible thing. Judy was maybe. You know, having her folks, but we got to talk off the air about this, even though I've talked on the air about it, but that's a book, I think, you know, and you could call it.
Yeah, those are all
panel.
My people. And I got to sit next to Tiffany at the Mickey Willis movie premiere and one of the pandemic ones. Anyway, so
okay. John Cullen, he was there. He was on the panel too. Yeah. I'll send you the links to all the shows and tell me what you think. We'll see what we can do with it.
Yeah. Love it. No, those were people that I was following from the beginning. I can't remember. So I sent you a blog post that I wrote in May of 2020. Mm-hmm. It was 6 weeks in, right? 6-8 weeks in to flatten the curve. And already I was calling BS. I was like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not watching. Yeah. I was at the beginning. You know, it was novel. We were scared. We didn't know. When I moved last year, and in packing, I found a Ziploc bag with a Target receipt and some change, like dollars and change, because I had sent one of my daughters to Target for me, and she didn't know what to do with the dirty money after the cashier had touched it. Like, that's where in the head.
Okay.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's start at the beginning.
So, I want to hear
your COVID story. Let's go back to the very beginning when you first, before you even heard, because I actually had COVID before we knew what it was. I had it the end of December 2019, beginning of January 2020 for about 2 weeks. Worst cough I ever had. Rested for 2 days and I was fine. And I was 60 at that point. Now I'm 63. And so that was my experience. So I'll say my story a bit, but I don't hear your story. So where do you start? Where was your first interaction with the virus, SARS-CoV-2? What's your earliest memory?
COVID hits, like when they very first started talking about, this is a thing and it might be coming to America. My husband was about to go to California, and I was like, maybe you shouldn't go. I don't know if I want you on a plane. And it was like, his trip was like 10 days out or something. And he's Mr. like, milk doesn't go bad. Expiration dates are just for fun. You know, he has no fear. In life, he has no fear.
Yeah.
So was like, I don't know. So it's the day before he's going. And now it's kind of, it's everywhere. It's every news story. There's multiple cases in the United States and blah, blah, blah. So I was like,
are we like mid-January or mid-February 2020? What time period are we talking about? Mid-February.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
February. So I said, you know what? I'm just going to go get you some Clorox wipes. Just wipe off your area on your plane. I mean, I don't know what I'm doing, right? I told you, not a doctor. So I go to Target, no Clorox wipes. I go to Randall's. I go to HEB. I go everywhere. There's no Clorox wipes. So I come home and I'm Googling.
This is an airborne virus, so that wouldn't
make.
Matter anyway. That's the funny part about it. It's like all that cleaning stuff
we
is for nothing.
The whole thing is so stupid in retrospect. I get angry even admitting that I fell for it for 30 seconds, but I did. And I did, you know, it can't hurt you to extra
you're
wash
allowed.
Your hands. It can't hurt you to, you know, do these things. So
he
goes and he comes back and, you know, we were still kind of like, we were very social and friends would say, do you want to come over? You can come in through the back door. And I was like, come around the back and we'll just hang out on the patio. And I would be like, you're not going to let me use your bathroom if I have to pee. Like, this is so silly. We're not like these germ vectors. We're not, it nothing made sense. So because I am a researcher, I just started looking for things. One of the first things I found was an interview with Tess Laurie, who, if you haven't had her on, she's fantastic.
I'm not familiar with her.
She's featured prominently in the book. She was like an advisor to the World Health Organization. She's a doctor. I saw an interview with her about some guy that was trying to talk about tackling, you know, all the hesitancy around this virus. Like, people aren't taking it seriously enough. And they thought she was going to be like, oh no, you need to lock yourself in your houses. And she was like, no, we're completely overblowing this. It's a flu. And, you know, so I was like, okay.
Exactly.
Interestingly enough.
It's a flu bug, people.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But
and it's not even as bad as real flu bugs. You know, that's
no,
that's
it, exactly. Exactly. So from day one, I'm watching all these numbers and I'm hearing doctors, you know, say the people who are having a really hard time with this have all these comorbidities. And so I just started doing what I do, which is what is it called? Poke the bear. I think that's what it's called.
Yeah.
What I do, like, hey guys, I know what you're seeing on CNN and even Fox and MSNBC. I know what you're seeing.
Yeah, but it's all wrong.
Other people out here saying something different. Like, why wouldn't you be open to both sides? And from day one, Greg, the animosity, the vitriol, the you are evil, you are selfish, get your vaccine or stay at home. I hope you
you're gonna kill grandma.
Like, what?
You're gonna kill grandma.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it was so clear to me that it was such an intentional, it was divisive, it was virtue signaling, it was you were either good or you were bad, or you were selfish or you were noble. And it, you know, so I sent you the thing I wrote. The very first thing I wrote was a blog post the title was I Will Drive. And the analogy I made was, yeah, it's sometimes it's dangerous to get behind the wheel, right? People die in car accidents every single day. Every single day, people die in car accidents. Now, if you said to me, hey, Jenna, listen, tomorrow my elderly grandmother is going to be driving around and she's a terrible driver. She can't see at all. Will you do me a favor and stay home so that she can get where she's going? I would go, you're smoking crack. No, your grandmother needs to not drive, honey. Yeah. That's what needs to happen. So my point was, since when do we quarantine healthy people to protect the vulnerable? We don't.
That was exactly my question. You can't. And constitutionally, you can't do it. So my legal background, although I'm not a lawyer, although I play one on the radio, I mean, I write legislation. And here's what I say, because you can use this line too. I say that I am uniquely unqualified for everything I do here at Action Radio. I don't have a communications degree. I don't have an English degree. You know, I don't have a broadcast degree. I don't, you know, I don't have a law degree. I don't have an economics. Well, I have an economics bachelor, but I don't have a PhD. I don't have, you know, anything. I'm not a firearms instructor. Yeah, we just, you know, went over that the last hour. I mean, none of the things I do here I'm qualified for. It doesn't stop me. We, you know, created an Action Radio.
But what makes you qualified?
Well, I'm the only one that's ever done
this. In every medical school graduating class, there's a couple of people that cheated. There's a couple of people that barely scraped by. There's the guy that finished dead last, right? Like, what, you read more books than I did? I mean, that's really the difference between any professional. You read more books than I did.
Maybe we should start asking it when someone says, well, they're an expert. Well, I should ask, are they a good expert or a bad expert?
Right.
I mean, I never thought about that until just now. Because this cult of the expert, you know, is so strong. And that's why they use it, right? And they say, well, this person's a doctor. You know, Dr. Fascist is an expert. I said, yeah, well, he's an expert at killing mass numbers of people. He's great at that.
Right.
He's great at making money. You know, for himself and all his other government employees. Have you noticed that no government employee has, especially the health department people, have had COVID vaccine injuries?
Yeah.
Neither has any member of Congress. Have you noticed that?
Mm. Mm. Yep.
How about that? You know why?
Because
they didn't get it.
Because they're not getting the real thing. Yeah.
They got saline. Yeah. Guarantee it. So there's a research project for you. We're on the same page here. So this is my brief history. February 25th, Dr. Peter Pry, one of my favorite people in the world, who I believe was killed by a COVID shot a year ago, August, introduced me to Bill Gertz, who was who is the national security correspondent for Washington Times. February 25th of 2020, he comes on and talks about the Wuhan lab. So we knew all about the Wuhan lab. 2 days later, I wrote a bill for Congress, saying that Congress could only spend half their money on vaccines. The other half had to be spent on early treatments because I already read the DDRO report. Okay. 3 days after that, March 2nd, we come out and say that chloroquine cures COVID. There is no pandemic. There's no need for a vaccine. Why would you wait 15 years for a vaccine when the virus is here right now and we already have a cure? So this is March 2nd. Okay. So March 21st, I come up with a whole video as saying everything the government doing is unconstitutional. I'll send you that video. So we were with you. We were about on this, and all of us, there's a bunch of us around the country. Dr. Zelenko, who became a friend of mine, was on the show a couple of times. We wrote a bill reforming the FDA. You know, we're all seeing the same thing. Early treatments work. You know, you can't, there's no reason to go through this warp speed. You know, Trump was totally deceived, totally lied to. And for some reason, he went along with this. But there was no reason for any of it. Peter Navarro had 80 million hydroxychloroquine tablets ready to go. We had to stop COVID. And I have the CDC chart, which goes on every show that I do. I've got the CDC chart showing that the death rate for COVID by July of 2020 was pretty much zero. It's right there. It's their own chart. You can't find it anymore.
Peter
says
early in our book, like the war on ivermectin was not the first skirmish. The war on somebody could have written the war on hydroxychloroquine because they did the exact same damn thing. And it was so calculated. And so like we actually lay out in the book the steps of the deceit and the disinformation campaign. And, you know, the irony is that the people who were the masters of disinformation deflected that. And that's the actual word that they used for the people spreading the truth, right? So it's like, I'm not a liar, you're a liar. Well, if I call you a liar, I'm not a liar. It was like something out of The Princess Bride. It was insane, but continue.
No, this is fascinating. So let's cut the chase here a little bit here. Why did they demonize hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin? Why was that essential for the process?
Because the only way they could have gotten the fake emergency use authorization, the EUA, that they got for the bait and switch vaccines. I mean, the whole thing is a sham anyways, but they could not get emergency use. In other words, the ability to force it down our throats without the necessary and proper safety and efficacy testing. The only way you can get that EUA is if there is not a single alternative. If there is a treatment, a viable treatment that can be shown to be effective, you cannot have EUA. Why? Because there's no emergency need for it. We have a treatment, right? But they needed to say, this virus is going to kill people. We absolutely have to just get this vaccine out as soon as we can. There's nothing else that could possibly help. Like, you know, they used all the fear porn. And in order to do that, they did, again, all the things that we outline in the book. They used fraudulent trials. They changed the endpoints. They corrupted the journals that were, you know, reporting on the studies. They made bastardized every positive study on ivermectin and hydroxy. You know, they pulled every trick in the book. They pulled every trick in the book.
That's it. That's it, right? That is, you get it. And I knew you would, but that's why I wanted it stated for the record that the only way that they could get billions of dollars in COVID bogus vaccine shot money was to take the cures that we already knew about and make the cures illegal. Because by doing, the only way they could make their illegal so-called vaccine, the messenger RNA shot, the only way they could make the COVID shot legal was to make the legal cures, which had already been proved, and the keyword is approved, they had to make those illegal so that they could get their emergency use authorization. So that is, yep, that is the ultimate fraud. That is the medical holocaust right there. They took the cure, yeah, knowing it was the cure, both of them, ivermectin, we'll get on to exactly what ivermectin is in a second, but they took the cures that they knew were the cures. Fauci even said so back in 2005. Dr. Fauci said in 2005, hydroxychloroquine cures COVID, cures SARS-CoV, I think, 1 at the time. So they knew. Judy Mikovits has got this all outlined in Plandemic. She knew. They knew.
Oh, yeah.
You know, so everybody that knew exactly what was going on knew that they were lying, that they had to lie. They had to demonize the one cure so they could bring about something that was not only a cure, but actually spreads the disease so they could market more of it. It is a medical holocaust. So let's be really clear about that. And I know you and I agree on that. So what's ivermectin?
It was initially developed, won the Nobel Prize, incidentally, as an antiparasitic. How about that? And then, you know, the two doctors that recently were awarded the Nobel Prize in Medicine for the deadly mRNA technology. Not Robert Malone, the ones that actually worked on the part of that technology that enhances the spike protein and kills people. So
in other words, this is medicine reverse, folks. So this isn't the Nobel Prize for medicine. This is the Nobel Prize for anti-medicine. This is the Nobel Death
for murder.
Prize.
Yeah.
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 The murder prize.
So
yeah.
Ivermectin was it was studied in human and veterinary form, incidentally, and it was intended to treat parasitic infections. It was almost exclusively responsible for eliminating river blindness and all sorts of other horrible, you know, parasites, lice, scabies, stuff like that. But had already shown antiviral promise as well as anti-cancer, by the way, another thing that they don't want people to know about because it
can't cure cancer. We got too much chemotherapy money. Yeah. It can't cure cancer.
Oh,
there's
exactly.
Another book for you. Yep.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I make these really superficial analogies all the time, but this is a true story. I worked in fashion and beauty for years, and I remember interviewing a designer once because they had made these stockings, women's stockings, pantyhose, whatever you call them, and they were absolutely amazing. I was like, I've never had stockings like this that don't run, and they're like, oh, we can make stockings that don't run all day, every day. But you'd buy one pair and you'd never need another pair of stockings.
Yeah, the original stockings, nylon stockings, didn't run. That was one of the problems for them. They'd make them and women never bought new ones. Yeah, because they didn't have the built-in obsolescence.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yep. So what did they do?
Yep. just make them just a little bit flimsy. And, you know, you can buy the $20 pair that seems outrageous, but you might be able to wear those 4 or 5 times. Or you can buy the 99-cent pair. They're going to run before you leave the house. You're going to have to bring 2 extra pairs in your purse for when you snag them on your
bootstrap. How about just not wearing stockings at all? How about just not wearing stockings? You know, that's another option, too. Yeah, conditioning.
You know, it's fashion, Greg. You can't. Well, I haven't worn stockings in years, but you know, back in the day, that was a thing. So yes, they wanted to hide all of this. And ivermectin, of course, was off patent. Anybody can make it. You can make generics, right? So when a drug manufacturer has a brand new drug, they own the patent for X amount of time and they can charge ungodly, obscene amounts of money for it. Once the patent expires, that just means any other competitor with a cooktop and a recipe can make that. And therefore, it's what the market will bear, right? So it's supply and demand and how many people can make it. And now ivermectin was down to pennies. It was available over the counter in countless countries around the world. It's taken prophylactically in countries around the world for virus prevention. What is the other word for prophylactically?
Prevention.
Preventatively.
I just like to define terms for people so that everybody. We have a lot of listeners in other countries too, so I want to make sure that we get, we get our words defined. But yeah, prophylactic. In other words, prevention. So that you don't
prevention,
get it.
Right. Medical professionals, like in South American countries, we're taking ivermectin, you know, as a preventative. They'll take one dose a week rather than taking a course of 5 days or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But that was one of the ways they falsified the ivermectin studies. This was so interesting to me in researching this book. In all the South American trials, they would quote unquote have a placebo group, right? And then they would give the other groups ivermectin. Well, guess what? The placebo group was always taking ivermectin. They were taking it regularly and routinely. So end of the day, ivermectin group didn't show a significant improvement, do you understand why? It's really hard to prove that taking ivermectin is better than taking ivermectin. You know what I'm saying?
I've never heard that before. But that's hysterical. So the placebo group, they would have had to go off their ivermectin, but that would have been stupid because they were preventing, you know. So what's the connection between parasites and viruses? Why does ivermectin kill both? Because they're not necessarily, parasites are a more complex, higher life form, you know, worms versus, you know, tiny little genetic material wrapped in whatever that stuff is around them. What do they have in common?
This is where you go way outside of my pay grade. Does her own research. I never researched that.
Welcome to Action Radio.
I don't really
impossible
know.
Questions
I really
are, yeah.
don't. I don't impossible understand the mechanism by which it helps either or cancer or any of the other things. I know is that, you know, the scientist who found it in a like field in Japan, by the way, who found the essence of what would ultimately become ivermectin. He was working on this early in COVID and he believed that it could be helpful. And Merck was the original pharmaceutical company that made ivermectin. Obviously, like I said, it was already off patent at this point in the early 2000s, 2020, excuse me. But
so it's like 60 years
the
old, right?
Inventor
this has been around for
Merck.
It's been around for like 60 plus years, right?
50 years. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It's on the WHO list of essential medicines. It has been administered billions of times. I don't think
Except
there's ever been a death associated with ivermectin, as far as
I know. That's the other question, too. So even if you're not sick with COVID, even if you don't have parasites, taking ivermectin is not going to hurt you.
I give it to my kids all the time. All the time.
Yeah.
They're like, my throat's a little scratchy. Here you go. Take some ivermectin.
So what is ivermectin?
No, for real.
I know this may not be your field either, but chemically, what is it? What kind of a compound is it? Is it purely manufactured? Does it occur mostly in nature? Do they take like an herb and, you know, add stuff to it? What is it?
It was some sort of plant matter that this Japanese scientist found in, it was like at the edge of a golf course or some crazy thing. Like he would just go around the world taking soil samples and looking for, like the whole chapter on that in this book is insane. It's like if it wasn't this one person on this one day after a rain in this hemisphere at this time of year, it never would have been discovered. Like it really is an interesting story. But like I said, I'm just the wordsmith. I don't understand the mechanism of it.
Okay.
So I would be foolish to even pretend.
And don't worry about what you don't know. I am known for asking impossible questions. I do it. Derek, my financial guy, gets constantly frustrated. He's like, Greg, I haven't looked that up. You know, we'll just do it next week. I don't care. You know, we'll have you back. Listen
well,
to the podcast.
I told you, I have no problem saying that's not my wheelhouse. I'm not good at that.
Exactly.
I don't know
no,
that.
That's fine. Yeah, I have
yeah.
to.
Yeah. So anyway, but, we got a little bit off track, but I wanted to finish very, very quickly the story of how I got to be so lucky to be able to write this book with Pierre, because honestly, I say all along, like, I feel like I'm the dorky, nerdy kid, the dorky, nerdy freshman, and the senior football, the quarterback asked me to prom. Like, what? Because he was
like, you're
like
the Padawan. Is like Star Wars Padawan.
Yeah.
Mm, strong in the force, you're going to be with Yoda. Mm. Sorry. It's a hobby.
I'm terrible at references. I'm terrible. But yeah, so I was just following him. I was, you know, just, oh, thank God that there are people out there testifying in front of Congress, for God's sake. I would share all of his stuff. Of course, then he founded the FLCCC, which is the Frontline COVID Critical Care Alliance. And they were, from day one, they were putting together early treatment protocols. They were advocating for, you know, that you don't need to go to the hospital. And if you do go to the hospital, this is what you need to ask for. Don't let them give you this. Like, I just felt, wow, here are these people that I respect so much. They're being demonetized, deplatformed, demonized for trying to help people for free. Like, if I see one more person on Twitter, like, I'll retweet stuff that Pierre tweets. And of course, 99% of it is, oh my gosh, you're amazing. You're a hero. You're a lifesaver. But there's always some jackass that will say, okay, grifter. And I'm like, do you have a dictionary?
Yeah, it's horse medicine, man.
Do you know what a grifter is? Like, that's somebody who's trying to profit off of a situation. This man has done nothing but travel the world. He lost 3 jobs. He lost his certification. Like, he lost the career he loved. He was an academic doctor. You know, he was a teaching doctor, which was his passion. Can't do that anymore because he, you know, so it's like, and people will say, oh, well, you prescribe ivermectin. Dr. Corey prescribes ivermectin. Yeah, it's a generic off-patent medicine. The whole prescription is $12. He's not getting a kickback for that. That's not like the Paxlovid. That's not one of the ones that, oh, you know, oh my gosh, we could go on for years and years and years about all the dirty doings
back
of the pharmaceutical companies.
This is just our first, meet. We're gonna do a lot more of these. Do you talk about in the book what we call here the Remdesivir Ventilator Death March? You talk about that at all?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, Pierre, we had a line in the book. Are we allowed to be profane on this podcast?
Oh, yeah. Go for it.
Like, really profane or just a little? I gotta be
no,
clear.
No, you can be really profane if it's justifiable. I don't like a lot of F-bombs being dropped gratuitously. But if you've got a real reason for doing it, go for it.
I don't do gratuitous profanity, but a well-timed F-bomb is more powerful than anything else I know. But, okay, so Pierre and I both are potty mouths, I'll tell you that. We kept this book I wish you could see the desk sign that sits on my desk. It's effer in charge of you effing effers. I'm looking at it with my eyeballs, okay? My kids gave me that. I mean, like, I'm a potty mouth. And so is Pierre. So, but we knew that we had to keep this book kind of clean. So we have this whole section about the whole ventilator thing, and it enrages him because people were venting people too soon. They were venting them too long. They were venting them without studying what doctors call the work of breathing, which is you can't just go by oxygen level. You have to go by all these other things. And they weren't. They were arbitrarily picking a number. If your oxygen saturation goes below whatever it was, 92, you're on a vent. And, you know, Pierre said, we took this line out, but I loved it because it's so Pierre. He said, people come up to me all the time and they say, a ventilator killed my grandmother. And he's like, a ventilator did not kill your grandmother. A pussy-ass doctor killed your grandmother. A pussy-ass doctor that wouldn't do his own research, that wouldn't use his own innate intelligence and experience and say, you don't just arbitrarily stick a tube down somebody's throat just because of this number. And but people were like, but that's the protocol. That's what the hospital is saying. So the hospital was, every hospital, they were given money. They were incentivized. They you know, the more people they had on vents, the more money they got. The more people that died, the more money they got. I mean, it was just a killing machine. It was a killing machine. And the people like Pierre and Mary Tally Bowden and Paul Merrick and, you know, all the people that you've had on your show that were out there mm-hmm. saying,
haven't had Paul
watching
yet.
This.
Yeah.
Oh, Paul is so dear. Paul
I think
Merrick
you're
going
to introduce me to people too. So, I mean, we'll be talking off the air. There's some folks I want to talk to. Yeah.
Honestly, I have the biggest crush on Paul. He's such a sweet man. If you Paul mm-hmm. Merrick is he is, I believe, the most published critical care doctor in the world. He created a protocol for sepsis that literally changed the industry. I'm going to get these numbers wrong again because Pierre could whip them out forward and backwards and tell you them mm-hmm. in French. But
I'll get him for an hour sometime. Yeah, we'll get him on. Yeah.
Hospital deaths associated with sepsis before Paul's protocol were like 80% and they went down to like 8. I mean, the man is just a wonderful genius. And every time he testifies, he's testified in front of Congress multiple times too. He cries. He's like, he's just such a sweet man and he's so passionate about this. And he too has lost everything. He's been discredited. They actually went back at the height of COVID and they tried to get his original work on sepsis discredited. They tried to say his studies were fraudulent. Doctors around the world were like, hell no. Like, now you've gone too far. You have gone too far. And so they wrote this open letter and they got that shut down. But I mean, it's all documented in the book, but honestly, it's almost unfathomable, even to this day, even after knowing all the evil and that they let people die. They let people die on ventilators. They let people die by
withholding all these
treatments.
They didn't let them die. They killed them.
Yeah.
Let's be blunt here.
Did.
Yeah. Yep. So how did we get in a position where, and I talk about this because I had open heart surgery to have a mitral valve trimmed so it fit properly because I was losing half my blood was going backwards in my heart. And they said, well, you could be dead in 5 years from myocarditis. I know what that is intimately because I studied it before I had the heart surgery. I'm fine now. I'm working great, you know, doing exercising, losing weight, everything's great. So that part of medicine worked. Then they gave me blood thinners that almost killed me when my chest filled up with fluid, and we drained it rather than put me on a ventilator. But today they would have put me on a ventilator and killed me. You know, so I'm intimately aware of this. But what happened in medicine between when I had really good heart surgery in 2016 and 2019 when they released COVID in 2020? They had COVID in 2021. They were giving out the COVID death shots. What happened to medicine that they changed the incentive from saving people's lives to killing people? What did you tell that story at all?
No, not really. I mean, I don't know what the trigger was. I mean, I've gone down the whole Rockefeller medicine rabbit hole about how, you know, there was this very intentional attempt and successful attempt to completely decimate any natural alternative. You know, which is so funny to me that we now call alternative medicine, like herbs, like, vitamins, you know,
yeah,
and this is something we start at the very beginning of the book. Pierre talks about, you know, how he was trained in medical school 30 years ago, right? Like
how was
vitamins
trained?
Were a joke. They were a scam. They were a scam industry. Of course they didn't work. Well, why? Because vitamin D, you can get it from the sun. All your other vitamins, you can get them from the food, right? If the medical field were going to acknowledge that vitamin D can reduce your chances of getting cancer, well, then you can't sell this other thing that they can make money off of. So anything, it just became, you know, sometime between Rockefeller and now, it mm-hmm. became, wow, we can make money on every single thing. We can create the sickness and then we can create the cure. We can spray the crops with the glyphosate and then we can, you know, completely decimate food. We can put chemicals in everything. We can get people on our diabetes medicines. Everybody will be overweight. Oh, they'll need Ozempic. Like everything is create the sickness, create the cure. I don't know when that happened or who was behind it.
Well, it's not really
frankly,
create the cure. It seems to be more perpetuate
the
disease.
There is no cure.
Because, well, now here's the people that I know that have gotten flu have gotten flu shots. The people that I know that have gotten COVID got COVID shots. So it's worse than that. I think these are actually self-perpetuating marketing devices that give you the very thing they tell you they're trying to prevent. There's nothing more dangerous for COVID than a COVID shot.
True but not true. Like, okay, everybody in my family got COVID and none of us got COVID shots. Did we get it bad? No. Did we take ivermectin? Yes. But I don't think you can say only people who got the COVID shot are getting COVID. Although,
No, I didn't say that. What I'm saying is
that
COVID, the shot, part of the shot is it's a marketing device to actually give you COVID and create variants. I think that's engineered in there. So I'm not saying, you know, and for your family, I mean, how many of your family got COVID a second time?
None of us, not one.
Bingo. Natural immunity.
Yeah, none of them. Not one.
Okay.
Yep.
So, but people who got the COVID shot have got COVID multiple
times.
Five,
six times.
How's that possible?
And they're on their TikTok saying, thank gosh they got their boosters or it would have been so much worse. I have a friend who almost died. Literally, she was 32 days in the hospital on a ventilator. Mm-hmm. And all she could say was, thank God I was vaccinated because I would have died. And I was like... Oh, honey, no.
Yeah, you never would have been in the hospital in the first place.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yep. There's so much crazy. I mean, there's so much crazy around this whole thing. It's still happening, right? You know that Dr. Merrick, who I was just talking about, and two other FLCCC affiliates, Mary Tally Bowden and Dr. Robert Apter, they filed a lawsuit against the FDA and HHS for... basically because they weren't allowed to doctor, right? They weren't allowed to, they all lost licenses and affiliations for trying to prescribe these medicines. And together they had a 99% patient survival rate, 99%. They saw the two alone, Mary Tally Bowden and Robert Apter saw more than, 9,000 COVID patients, 99% survival rate. That was not the case across the world, incidentally. And these are people that were hospitalized, right? So these are the sickest of the sick. This isn't me or you, you know, that lost our taste for a couple of days. These are people that had the comorbidities, went into the hospital, and were given all these things, the ivermectin and the monoclonal antibodies and all the quote-unquote off-patent, and they lost their jobs. Excuse me. They were, you know, completely smeared. And so they sued the FDA and the HHS. And it went to appeal. And basically, the FDA lawyer, this just happened within a month, basically said the FDA cannot prohibit off-label use of ivermectin, and then added, but this doesn't at all mean that ivermectin is approved by the FDA. So think about that for a minute. These
it's
three
been
doctors
approved.
Won
it's
that
It's already
case.
Been approved. Yeah,
is that right?
Been,
and doctors have always...
Years.
Have yeah. always been allowed to prescribe medication off-label. So yeah. they admitted without admitting that they acted illegally, which they did. The FDA had no right or authority. You know, they tried their defense was sovereign immunity. We have sovereign immunity, right? We're thinking of the common good and the best. And no, you actually never had that right. So thankfully, they won in the appeal court. And so now, but they still will not say it is okay for doctors to prescribe it. And in fact, there was Reuters did a fact check because it's like all these people are saying that the FDA says it's okay to treat with COVID. And the Reuters like summary was false. That's what they said. False. The FDA, it misleading. That's what they said. Ivermectin is not FDA approved to treat COVID.
Well, they can never admit that because that would give rise to the lie and everybody would know, of course we know, but that the lie is that they made the cures illegal so that they could kill people with their emergency use COVID shots or at least sell billions of dollars worth. So those that know that, they have to maintain that. That's like they have to maintain the fantasy that Biden won the 2020 election when all of us know it was a bunch of nonsense. There's no way he could have beaten a fair election. So we all know that, but they have to maintain the lie.
Let me ask you this, though.
As
a fellow conspiracy theorist, because this is one of the ones that I have a hard time answering because I'm a total
ongoing investigator.
I've written about it.
Ongoing investigator, please.
Okay, ongoing investigator. Do you, like I, believe that there was a very intentional goal of killing people with those shots?
I don't know if the goal was killing people because I know I hear a lot of people talk about the mass genocide, and I'm thinking the world government gains power by controlling more people. I don't think the goal is ever to kill people. I think the goal is to make money. I think
that's where I was going. Like if they wanted to kill us, they could kill us a million different ways. But then if they want all this power, and,
right.
and they want people to fly their private jets and raise their also their buco.
Food.
Like,
yep, clean the bathrooms.
For some of
yeah,
stuff.
Ain't gonna happen. Yeah, huh. But they want. See, I see this as I see them as parasites. In other words, they want to make you sick enough to make them rich, but they don't want to kill you because they want to keep living off you. So, in other words,
right.
they want to keep giving you a booster. Now, here's a question for you. I don't know if you talk about this in the book. Then I want to spend a few minutes on our vaccine liability bill. But the idea of this, it's messenger RNA technology. Messenger RNA teaches your body how to do things. It teaches your cells how to replicate. All right, then it teaches the DNA how to replicate. That's what RNA does, as far as I know. It could be wrong. You can tell me. But if your body learns from the first COVID jab, why would you need to give extra ones? Wouldn't the first one multiply
right.
enough times to teach your body how to replicate, you know, a proper immunity, which of course it doesn't. So the idea of boosters means that it doesn't work. Why would you need to boost something that's already teaching your body how to cure itself?
Exactly. That was the premise that made absolutely no sense. And,
okay.
well, you know, so I wrote a whole thing about this on my Substack about it. The title was Words Matter. My Substack is just my name, Substack, at Jenna McCarthy. You know, they went through COVID changing the definitions of everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
They changed the definition of a vaccine, you know, from something that confers immunity to something which may support immunity. They changed the definition of anti-vaxxer. Right? Anti-vaxxer
yep.
was someone who opposes vaccination. They literally changed the definition to someone who opposes vaccination or laws mandating it. Like, what? Like, can't I believe that it's fine for you to be vaccinated? I just thought we lived in a free country and
we used to. Not now.
Yeah.
So also herd immunity was changed. Remember the definition of herd immunity? How'd that get changed?
Yeah.
That's good for people to know.
It was the percentage, right? Like it was more than half or something at some point. I didn't cover that one, so I'm not exactly sure, but I know.
Okay, I'll just to let you know, they changed it to say that herd immunity used to be natural immunity. And then they changed it to say that herd immunity comes about because of vaccines. That's how they changed it.
Oh,
you can look that up. Yeah. Let me just a couple minutes. It's fascinating. Do we have a lot more to talk about? So I wrote a bill. Over 2 years ago, okay, so this is like March of 2021, bringing full vaccine product liability back to Big Pharma. I've had Malone. I've had Peter McCullough. I've had Ed Dowd. You know, I've had major people on this show. I had Christina Bob, Peter Navarro. I've had big guests on this show. Every one of them I've shared this bill, and not a single person has talked about it. I've had Pierre Corey. Now, Pierre Corey, here's a funny story for you. So Pierre's on the show, right? And I tell him about the bill. He says, well, congratulations, that's great, but it's not going to work. It's not going to go anywhere. And I said, not until you talk about it. So that's the first thing I'm going to ask him when he gets back on the show. So this bill, all it does is change three or four words. There's two places in law where it says vaccine manufacturers shall not be civilly liable. Well, I just changed shall not be to shall be fully. What's that, two words? You know, two words in two places.
Yeah.
So I changed two words in two places in law from shall not be liable to shall be fully liable, and that would put full product liability back on vaccine makers. Why is this not national news? Why isn't this circulating among America's frontline doctors? The only person who's telling people this is Judy Mikovits. She's the only one. Now, I just had Naomi Wolf on the show. I'm trying to get her to start doing it. Uh-huh.
Jeff Childers?
No, I don't. Oh, Jeff. The attorney?
Yeah.
Coffee and COVID? Yeah, he's been on the show. He won't do it either. Here it gets even worse.
Why?
You know who I've talked to personally? Steve Kirsch, who did the Atlanta lawyer summit on COVID. I said, Steve, why don't I just come speak? I've got the bill that cures all your problems. I can't get invited to a single conference. We've had the solution here for over 2 years. Maybe you can write about it in your
What about Ron Johnson? He's a huge proponent.
What about Ron
Senator
Johnson? Okay,
Ron Johnson.
You want me to break some news here? I've been thinking about doing this for a while. I promised my friend I wouldn't, but my friend has passed away. My friend was Dr. Zeb Zelenko, and we used to talk off the air a lot. He's been on the show twice. I can send you the news, or you can just look him up. Dr. Zelenko personally placed our vaccine bill in the hands of Ron Johnson over 2 years ago. Ron Johnson has refused to even talk about it. He's had two major hearings. He had Pierre Corey right there, you know, And he never brought it up. He's known about this bill over 2 years because I know, and like I said, I'm breaking news here. I promise I wouldn't say, you know, but Dr. Zelenko's been dead for almost a year now. So I don't think I'm breaking a confidence at this point. And besides, people need to know that Ron Johnson has had our vaccine product liability bill since I wrote it, basically, and has done nothing about it.
So why would you have promised Zev that you wouldn't talk about it?
I don't know, because he didn't want me to say it because it was a personal thing. He gave it to him. But I don't think I'm betraying a confidence at this point. Well, I can keep secrets. I'm really good at it. I know a lot of things I don't say on the air. But I knew that he gave it to him personally. And it was like, you know, because he told me personally. He says, you know, I don't want this to get out yet, but this is what he did. So I don't, like I say, I've sat on this for, you know, over a year. But I think it's good for people to know that Ron Johnson knows about our bill and has had two major hearings and has never brought it up.
Okay, let me say one thing. I have to go right after this, but I feel the need to defend Pierre because I'll tell you, Pierre
is out
there fighting all day, every day. Well, I feel like anybody, like I have had people make comments to me like, why don't you take all your vitriol and, you know, go out there and raise awareness about women's rights or like some other thing. And it's like, dude, you can fight any battle you want. This is what I'm doing. This is what I'm fighting. Like I am fighting, like Pierre is fighting vaccine injury. Pierre Corey has never once, not one time, refused to see a friend of a friend of a friend if somebody's like my daughter's mail carrier is in the hospital with COVID and doesn't know what to do. He treated my sister when she was in the hospital for pneumonia, and would not take any money. Like I had to send him presents because he wouldn't. I mean, he there's only so many hours a day. He's out there. I want you to not feel personally like why he could do so much with this. Well, he could do so much with a million things.
No. I understand that. All I'm asking Pierre to do and all these doctors to do is just talk about it publicly. I expect the legislators to do something. But if Pierre mentions it, and I was talking about the show, he loved the bill. He just thought it wasn't going to go anywhere. It's exactly what happened with Ron Johnson. He absolutely said these politicians will not do it. They're in the pocket of Big Pharma. So what we really need are millions of people to send that bill to Congress and say, look, if you don't pass this, I'm not voting for you. That's how we're going to be.
There's a
Big Pharma's
story
the problem.
In the book about Newt Gingrich, and I'll leave it at that because I do have to go. I have another interview right now.
Okay. Got to go. Let's get the book. Where do you get it? Warren
so
Ivermectin.
I'm grateful for you having me on here. People can find me at Substack, Jenna McCarthy, my website, jennamccarthy.com. The War on Ivermectin is, of course, available on Amazon. I found it in buried in the medical ethics section in the Barnes & Noble in New York City. So who knows where it might be at your bookstore. But I always ask folks, like, hey, if you're ever in a bookstore, just ask for it. Put it on their radar. Just make them look it up in the system and be aware of it. If you do that for me, I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Jenna. We'll talk soon, especially off the air.
I really appreciate it.
Go to your next interview. Time. Good luck. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, thanks.
All right.
You too. Bye.
Okay. Bye now. Yeah, so we're actually in overtime now. So we timed that up to the last minute. So Jenna McCarthy, the book is The War on Ivermectin, which she co-wrote with Dr. Pierre Corey. And he's right. I mean, why have I been sitting on that information? It's something that people should know. Well, because I promised a friend, you know, I wouldn't say anything. And like I say, at this point, it's more important for that knowledge to get out there. So let me just, we've got our contact information. We've got other things to do. I didn't play a single thing because Fridays are crazy busy around here. Marco, Marco's probably already gone. Take care, Marco. See you later. This has been an incredible day. So share the podcast, share our bills, go to writeyourlaws.com, you know, when it's not being hacked, which it is right now, and get everything out there. So we'll start again Monday. We shall do it all again Monday morning at 7 a.m. Central Time, and we'll see you then. Here is your Action Radio contact and website information. The call-in line is 215-383-3832. Our show site is blogtalkradio.com/citizenaction. Same link, live and a podcast. Please share all our shows. We have live chat at the bottom of the broadcast page available worldwide. Sign in to your free account and type away. We have an internet Skype line where you can call the show worldwide also. Please see the broadcast page for our Skype name. Call in during the show to get approved. Our bill writing site is writeyourlaws.com, WriteYourLaws, writeyourlaws.com. This is where anyone can write a bill and start the process of it becoming law. My paid and free subscription column is at gregpenglis.substack.com. Please consider a paid subscription of $5 per month or greater. For contributions to Action Radio, please go to givesendgo.com/actionradio. We have over 20 Action Radio Facebook groups. Use the Facebook search window by putting in Action Radio to find our groups. My public email is greg@writeyourlaws.com. Please contact me about advertising on Action Radio and helping our mission of freedom. Thank you for listening. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com. Well, that sounds good. Even better. Okay, how about your car? If you want the best service for your vehicle, please talk to James at Florida Stores Automotive. Conveniently located at 6715 Caroline Street in the historic district of Milton, Florida, right between the Milton Bakery and the Blackwater Trail. Whether you need an oil change or an entire engine replaced, this is the place. The phone number is 850-623-6651. That's 850-623-6651. Call, ask questions, and get the information you need. Florida Stores Automotive is a full-service automotive shop for both domestic and imports, modern and classic. It is a family-owned business here in our Milton community. Open weekdays from 7:30 to 5 p.m., Florida Stores Automotive is a convenient place to keep your car maintained and on the road. Ask them about Firestone tires and the rotation and maintenance plan. Florida Stores Automotive. I go there. You should too. Do you know your way around healthcare, insurance, pharmacies, surgery, alternative treatments and choices? I don't. Which is why I'm so glad I met Priscilla Romans, had her on Action Radio, and learned about health patient advocacy. She is the founder of Grace Care. And now as an affiliate of Grace Care, we are proud to offer through our discount code, WYL, which stands for Write Your Laws, a 10% discount. Grace Care saves you both time and money. They provide medical advocacy, consultation, advice, and recommendations nationwide. Their website is gravecare.com. That's GRAITH care.com. You can email them at gravecare.adm@gmail.com or call them at 469-864-7149. That's 469-864-7149. Gravecare, better health through better knowledge and advocacy. This is Greg Penglis for Strike Force, your source for pure energy. Strike Force is a concentrated energy drink that turns a half liter of your favorite beverage into an energy drink. You make your energy drink yourself. Action Radio is an affiliate of Strike Force, so our listeners get a 20% discount. All you do is add our code, WYL, to the discount code window at checkout. WYL comes from our website, Write Your Laws. So, you can get your energy drink, a 20% discount, and help Action Radio change the relationship of we the people to our government. Not bad. Strike Force is at StrikeForceEnergy.com. That's StrikeForceEnergy.com. Start your engines. Action Radio. Part of the ADHD Radio Network. The ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio.